All right, Madam Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning, the hour of 10 o'clock having arrived on Thursday, December 17th, 2020. I call this meeting of the State Lands Commission to order. I'm State Controller Betty Yee, and welcome to our completely virtual State Lands Commission meeting. Ms. Lucchese, will you please call the roll of the commissioners in attendance?
Certainly. Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis.
Present.
Gail Miller, representing the Department of Finance.
Present.
Chair and State Controller Betty Yee.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum present. In addition, I would like to identify the members of the staff of this commission and the Attorney General present for this virtual meeting. I am Executive Officer Jennifer Lucchese. I'm here with Chief Counsel Seth Blackman, Meeting Liaison Kim Lunetta, Assistant Executive Officer Colin Connor, Supervising Deputy Attorney General Andrew Bogle, and our Zoom co-hosts Katie Robinson-Phillip, Mike Farina, and Phil Slater.
Great, thank you very much. For the benefit of those joining us virtually, the State Lands Commission manages state property interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. The commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine oil terminals and offshore oil platforms, and for preventing the introduction of marine invasive species into California's marine waters. Today, we will hear requests and presentations involving the lands and resources within the commission's jurisdiction. We recognize that the lands we manage have been inhabited for thousands of years by California's native people, and take seriously our trust relationship with these sovereign governments. I want to take a moment to honor the California Native American communities all across the state for persisting, carrying on diverse cultural and linguistic traditions, and sustainably managing the land that we now share. Native people have maintained a constant presence on the landscape for many thousands of years, and they are essential stewardship partners, whether along the coast, along our rivers and valleys, or in our fragile deserts. We thank California Native American communities for participating in the Commission's activities and for their essential role in maintaining and adding to our state's rich cultural legacy. The next item of business will be public comment. Before I open the public comment period up for items not on the agenda, first let me thank everyone, especially our stakeholders and members of the public, for taking the time to join our virtual meeting. While these virtual meetings are becoming more routine, this is still a relatively new experience for most of us, and we appreciate your support and patience as we work together in this new medium. Now I want to turn it over to Ms. Lucchese to quickly share some instructions about how we can best participate in this meeting so that it runs as smoothly as possible.
Thank you, Chair Yee. First, everyone, please make sure you have your microphones or phones muted to avoid any background noise. For members of the public, if you would like to speak either during our open public comment period or during a public comment period that is part of an agenda item, you will need to do so in one of two ways. First, if you are attending on the Zoom platform, please raise your hand in Zoom. If you are new to Zoom and you joined our meeting using the Zoom application, click on the hand icon at the bottom of your screen. When you click on that hand, it will raise your hand. Second, if you are joining our meeting by phone, you must press *9 on your keypad to raise your hand to make a comment. If you are calling in and want to view the meeting, including the PowerPoint presentations, please view the meeting through the CalSPAN live webcast link. There will be a slight time delay, but it will avoid an echo or feedback from using the Zoom application and your phone. If you emailed us with a request to speak, please also raise your hand so we don't inadvertently miss you. We will call on individuals who have raised their hands in the order that they are raised using the name they registered with or the last three digits of their identifying phone number. After you called on, you will be unmuted so you can share your comments. Please also remember your computer or phone and identify yourself. Remember, you have a limit of 3 minutes to speak on an item. Please keep your comments respectful and focused. We will mute anyone who fails to follow those guidelines or at worst dismiss them from the meeting. Finally, every now and then you will hear me refer to our meeting host. Our commission staff are acting as hosts for the meeting behind the scenes to ensure that the technology moves the meeting forward smoothly and consistently. The commission has also established an email address to compile public comments for our meetings. Its address is cslc.commissionmeetings@slc.ca.gov. We have received various emails from parties that have been shared with all the commissioners prior to the meeting. If we receive any emails during the meeting, they will be shared with the commissioners and be made available on our website at www.slc.ca.gov, along with the public comment emails and letters we have already received. Chair Yee, that concludes my virtual meeting instructions. We are ready to move to the general public comment period.
Thank you, Ms. Lucchese. And before we move on, I just wanted to make an announcement and introduction of Marianne Warmerdam, who is the Deputy Controller for Environmental Policy, just recently joining us, and you will likely be seeing much more of her in the future. Welcome, Marianne. Our next order of business is the public comment period. If anyone wishes to address the commission on any matter not on today's agenda, please raise your hand and you will have 3 minutes to do so. I'll now turn to Katie to see if she would please call on the first person who would like to make a public comment.
Thank you, Chair Yee. The first person making a comment during general public comment will be Lisa Levinson, followed by Marsha Hanscom.
Thank you. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here today. Just waiting for my computer here for a second. Sorry about that. Okay. Great. So thanks again for inviting public comments. I'm Lisa Levinson with In Defense of Animals, an international animal protection nonprofit with 250,000 supporters and 25,000 in California. 12,000 of our supporters signed petitions to protect Biona wetlands and stop the counterfeit restoration project that would bulldoze the area. Just last week, Defend Biona Wetlands announced their new gentle restoration plan to foster species recovery and improve public access without bulldozing the reserve. We love the gentle restoration plan because it forms recovery teams to recover roadrunner, jackrabbit, California quail, horned lizard, garter snake, bald eagle, snow goose, sandhill crane, and Southern California sea otters to Biona. We also like the implementation of docent and youth ranger programs to teach respect and sustainability principles. Please read the 20-point plan at defendbionawetlands.org. Bulldozing Biona would destroy the habitat for rare white-tailed kites. 2 to 3 of these majestic raptors currently forage in the Biona grasslands, one of the most diminished California habitats. Gentle restoration can accomplish all of the goals of the counterfeit restoration, except refurbishing the gas storage facilities beneath the wetlands. Residents fear another Aliso Canyon blowout in their neighborhood. They want gas out of Biona, and so do we. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Lisa, for joining us.
Our next speaker is Marsha Hanscom.
Good morning, Marsha.
Good morning, Commissioner, or let's see, State Lands Commissioners. Yes, whether people are commissioners or board members, it's always a challenge in these virtual meetings. But I want to say first, I'm so grateful for your commission because I tell other agency people all the time, watch the State Lands Commission meetings because they are conducted in a way that helps the public really understand the way the commission works. And so I really appreciate all that you in your leadership, Chair Yee, and the rest of the commissioners and your staff conduct these meetings. I also want to say and draw to your attention the alternative number 4, the gentle alternative for the Biona wetlands, a 20-point plan that was released last week, put together by a number of community members and with the advice and counsel of a couple of really good biologists who know how to do recovery plans and how to do work in a sensitive ecological reserve area, which this is. And we will be sending you copies of that plan and hope that you will take the time to read it. And we would love for the State Lands Commission to consider taking a position on this. The other three alternatives that are being considered by the state at the moment are highly destructive and would actually harm the species that that the state spent $140 million for protecting in 2003. And I want to read the first point of the 20-point plan because you made me think of it right away, Chair Yi, when you opened the meeting, because this is one of the most important things we can do. One, form an Indigenous Tribal Council for Biona, consisting of elders for the Indigenous people for the LA coast, which would guide protection decisions for the land and which would be given access for historical lifeways activities such as gathering for prayers and other spiritual, religious, sacred ceremonies, and gathering plants for medicinal and basketry purposes. This has not been done in many of the state ecological reserves, and we really need to have that be first and foremost in our protected lands, and particularly at Biona, where hundreds of ancestors were dug up in a terrible, terrible project across the street from the ecological reserve when the Playa Vista development was built. So we hope you will again read this alternative plan and that you will embrace it as we have, and that you will inform the governor that this might be a much better way to solve things and move forward at the Biona Wetlands. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Marcia, for bringing that forward. Katie, our next speaker.
Thank you, Cherie. Our next speaker is Christina.
Hello there.
Good morning, Christina.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Wow, it's a privilege to speak with you, esteemed folks. You know, my name's Christina Koo, and I'm one of the founding members of the LA County Democratic Party. New charter club is called Democrats for the Protection of Animals. And our main mission is to promote humane treatment of animals and also promote humane legislation and government policies on animal protection issues at city, state, and federal levels. So we've been working on the Biona Wetlands Ecological Reserve issue. I don't know how much you know about it, but you know, we're finding out new information every day about ways that this area, 640 acres of beautiful, you know, wilderness, wetland, is facing some major challenges. And, you know, there's the SoCal gas tanks that are underneath it. And this whole situation, why so many people are getting involved, is that we're finding out that they're trying to reestablish at the wells and to refurbish them and putting in pipes and upgrading them. And so they've proposed to basically, you know, uplift and remove the whole wetlands area. And that is pretty shocking because any ecologist, environmentalist, and animal welfare expert will tell you that that means destruction. And what's really heartbreaking is that big companies like SoCalGas is phrasing this in a way that is really misleading the public. They've got weekly ads, large one-page advertisement that is using words that are misleading the public. And they're colorful ads that say they're calling it removing. They're helping the wetlands by removing these gas wells. Well, guess what, folks? What they're leaving out is that they are removing, which is excavating the whole area, the wetlands, the wildlife, all the nature. And they're also going to put new ones in surrounding areas. So they say remove, but they didn't put in, by the way, we're going to dig up more land and put new ones in. So it's an oxymoron. And we really want folks to realize that, learn that. That's why we need your help. This is what we're facing. And there are just, there are hundreds, thousands, 1,700 different kinds of species of animals and plants there that need your help. And we're really speaking on their behalf. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Christina. Katie, our next speaker.
Next speaker is Mary Beth Totwain.
Good morning, Mary Beth.
Good morning. My name's Mary Beth Trotwine. I'm a 20-plus year resident of Venice, and I'm an active kayaker and biker in the Marina and Playa del Rey areas. I would, just for the sake of time, like to emphasize what Lisa Levinson said about the Bayona wetlands, that 25,000 people have expressed concern about the treatment of animals and the need for the ecological reserve. And also to laud Marsha Hanscom's longtime work in bringing you, Betty Yee, to the wetlands, as well as seeing to the importance of gentle restoration, and that the defendbayonawetlands.org, the 20-point plan for gentle restoration. For me particularly, I love that option because in response to a 10-year plan from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife in their environmental impact report, where they suggest taking plants away with heavy machinery, essentially destroying the nature that is there to only replace it 10 years later, is not really a way to, in my view, be consistent with what our governor is calling for nature-based solutions to climate change. And then also just the harm that it will do to the neighborhood and the wetlands. And then also to emphasize what the previous speaker said about SoCal Gas. I don't know if she mentioned Mike Bonin, our city councilman, our state senator, Ben Allen, and our county supervisor, Janice Hahn, have all called either for a motion to explore or contacted the governor about removing equipment in the wetlands and the gas storage facility there. This is of great concern to me. In January of 2019, there was a blowout at a construction site in the marina. This has still gone unaddressed as far as I know. And then also, as dangerous as blowouts are, it's also the continued exposure to the chemicals stored at the gas plant facility. The gas stored there is fracked gas. It's come to the wetlands to be stored. And groups like the Physicians for Social Responsibility have expressed alarm at the human, at the health causes of chemicals used in fracked gas. These are being shipped to our neighborhood and being stored there, and there are leaks. Many studies have been coming out recently about methane, ethylene, and many other enes, chemicals that just are simply not compatible to human health. So I call on the board to consider these things. I know that oil and gas facilities are an important part of California's revenue in the past, but it's time to move away. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Beth. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Lisa Carlin.
Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for having us speak during public comment. Esteemed members of this particular commission, this loan commission. My name is Lisa Carlin. I'm an activist and I represent a group of individuals seeking to defend the Bayona wetlands. I just want to, it's been mentioned before, but I just want to reiterate that the proposed project at the Bayona Wetlands is not a restoration. It's a misuse of the term and it's designed to confuse. And the theme of my discussion this morning is about confusion, because that's how some industries get things done. They confuse the public. They confuse people that think they're doing the right thing and they're not. The purpose of this restoration is to help Southern California Gas maintain a storage facility that exists under the 640 acres of the Biona wetlands. And this storage area, these are fossil fuels. We're moving away from fossil fuels. Why are we putting the millions of dollars that were obtained through various bond measures into restoring something that should just be sealed off permanently and no longer available for storage? Because what they want to do is bulldoze it, basically erase all the land, all the life, all of the animals that live there, all the wildlife, especially the endangered species. That's why Marcia Hanscom spoke about having biologists on this team. We want you to look at our very gentle item number four restoration. There's 20 points. I'm going to read one section very quickly. This is point number six. While there are already 1,700 species present at Biona, including some endangered and threatened, work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to form recovery teams to recover this ecological reserve. The following species: animals, roadrunner, jackrabbit, California quail, horned lizard, garter snake, plants, Biona cinquefoil, salt marsh, bird's beak, and to determine the feasibility of additional species that would be compatible with those species currently relying on this proposal. The other thing I want to say is, just like the tobacco companies used to say, and I was part of a team that actually obtained this information through the Freedom of Information Act. The top of their paperwork said, remember, confusion is our product. That appeared many, many times in the tobacco company's defense. Confusion was the product. I don't want confusion to be the product here. We want to save the wildlife and preserve this ecological reserve at the Biona wetlands. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Suzanne.
Okay. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning. Good morning, esteemed commissioners. My name is Suzanne Cumming. I'm an attorney. I live in Marina Del Rey, and I'm a member of the Sierra Club and Defend Biona Wetlands. I'm asking you to stop the bulldozing plan for the Biona Wetlands. The State Land Commission, your commission, owns 60 acres here, but largely it's been left out of the planning process. We ask you to get involved. Please place on your agenda consideration for supporting option four, the general alternative that you've heard about, or withdraw the defective EIR based on bad science. And that's what the bulldozing plan is about, the options one and two, the bad science of the EIR. You've heard about the thousands of wild animals and plants living there that would be obliterated. The bulldozing plan, if carried out, would wreak havoc on the surrounding communities for 9 years at a cost of $270 million public dollars. A lawsuit has been filed. I'm sure you've heard about it. It alleges murky connections between the crumbling Southern California, the storage facility that you heard about under the wetlands, the State Coastal Conservancy, the Bay Foundation, and a couple of other high-profile groups that support bulldozing. The lawsuit alleges that this counterfeit restoration is a pretext for the real agenda of aiding Southern California Gas that you've also heard about today. Although Southern California Gas denies it in their extensive public media campaign, look at the EIR. The facts are there. This is what they're doing. Elected officials have called for investigating shutting down the storage facility with the Aliso Canyon disaster in mind. Please support them. I don't know if you know, the bulldozing plan also calls for a three-story parking garage on the wetlands. There is reason to believe that there may be an arrangement with a hotel developer nearby so that in exchange for parking in the garage, a hotel can be built up closer to the water. The express language in Proposition 12, passed by the voters in 2000, am I over my time? Almost.
You have 15 seconds. Yeah,
okay. 15 seconds. Please support the gentle option 4 of the EIR so we can move forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is someone calling in with the last three digits, 983.
Okay. Good morning. Our next caller, if you can hear me, you are on. Katie, perhaps we'll return to that caller. Is that all right?
Yes, thank you. Our next speaker is Robert Vanda.
Great. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak and helping me find the unmute button. It came up as a message. Click here. Happy holidays to you. Thank you so much for meeting during these difficult times of the COVID-19 virus pandemic. And I hope that you and your families and staff and the two commissioners are all staying safe. And I appreciate that we're having the meetings virtually, and I hope they continue this way after the virus, maybe some combination of in-person meetings, but also this way, because it really does allow access by the public to be able to speak from home and not have to travel and contribute to climate change in a vehicle. Okay. I'm so fortunate that I've been able to take both the Lieutenant Governor and the State Controller on tours at the Biona Wetlands. I'd like to continue that tour here with you briefly in words and relate to the Indigenous peoples' effort and the continuing journey of a particular native plant. Although I am a wildlife biologist, I have training in botany too, and there are wildlife issues connected to this native plant, like native butterflies and native bumblebees that pollinate this flowering plant. This plant is known in science, in botanical Latin, as Anemopsis californica, and in Spanish, Yerba Monza, and the Spanish derived the name from the Aztec Indian peoples. The plant was known in Mexico, but transported by trade, women matrilineally bringing the plant north into the United States region, into Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and finally to California. This plant, Yerba Monza, is medicinal. It helps with respiratory wounds, breathing. It helps with healing wounds very quickly. So magical is this plant that women, the grandmothers, mothers, daughters, all learned about and how to transport this plant and keep it moist. It needs watery. It can grow in a bucket of water, or it needs to be in wet soil. It can be a little bit salty soil or completely freshwater soil. The Paiute Indians in the Owens Valley had a name for this plant. There were actually more than 100 indigenous names for this plant in the Western North America. The plant has been at the Biona Wetlands for thousands of years and was brought to the State Lands Commission land not by Native American women, but by developers, and has planted kind of in violation of respect for this plant in the freshwater detention basin that the State Lands Commission owns and manages, and needs a revolutionary reform management And that's just a little bit of the story. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, very much. Our next speaker, Katie.
Our next speaker is Contra Costa, RCD.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Heidi Petty. I work for the Contra Costa Resource Conservation District as Watershed Program Manager. You've heard from me a couple times about the Crockett Waterfront. Yes. I appreciate that you all had a lovely meeting, town hall meeting last week regarding the Crockett Waterfront project. And I just wanted to let you know that we continue to work on this and that I actually have a grant in to help with the railroad crossing, keeping it open for pedestrians and keeping it available to the public. This has been, you know, as you know, a dumping ground for many years, and we finally got it all cleaned up between all of us, you know, putting in time and money, including the State Lands Commission putting in $400,000 to clean up old cars and such. And now that it's clean, we are basically being threatened with losing it because we can't afford the pedestrian crossing upgrade. So we saw at the meeting that there was a lot of funds available for cleanup, removal of barges, and some of the other things. And we're just hoping that State Lands will consider taking some of those funds and helping us to keep our railroad crossing open so that this community can enjoy this beautiful space, including the barge, which I believe you have, I think, $380,000 to remove, which I am currently working with Jonathan Todd to revamp into a beautiful planted, potentially educational platform. And this may be just something that California can use to revitalize these old sunken barges. So I would like you all to consider different alternatives and possibilities to this barge situation and these funding issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Jane Velez Mitchell.
Good morning, Jane.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. Let me see if I can put on the video, if I can, or is it just audio? Well, let me just proceed then. In the early 90s, I was a reporter at KCAL TV in Los Angeles. I covered a protest against Playa Vista, led by Martin Sheen, including indigenous leaders. And I spoke to the executives at Playa Vista, and they assured me, in no uncertain terms, that don't worry, there will be an area of the Bayona wetlands that will remain pristine and undisturbed. They said that to my face. They made a promise to my face. Here we are more than 20 years later, and there is a plan to bulldoze that very land, the Bayona wetlands, 640 acres. It has been described as dead and dying, but I live here. I walk through. I see all the animals, and we have photographic evidence of 1,700 species, some endangered, some threatened, who are living there and thriving there. And I see every day, I see the pelicans, I see the geese, I see the egrets, and I know that we do not need to bulldoze this entire area to achieve the legitimate goals of more public access. We're all for more public access. Of course, we want to see people in this densely populated urban area have access. That's why we'd like to see a gentle restoration, which is option four. And that option four has now been fleshed out with a 20-point plan that includes utilizing existing trails, creating informational tours so that children cannot just go there and see grass, but they can actually learn about the indigenous people who once called this area home, and learn about the threatened and endangered species that still exist there. We can unlock the gates. We can plant native species in a mindful way. We can clean up the perimeter so that it's beautified. It's a detailed 20-point plan, and I just humbly and respectfully urge you to consider it. In this time where wildlife and habitats are being destroyed due to climate change and wildfires, we need to think 21st century. Bulldozing is 20th century. 21st century is really thinking about how to do something in a sustainable, nature-based, mindful way. And we all know killing is not conservation. Destruction is not renovation or restoration. I urge you to avoid bulldozing and think about a gentle, evolved plan for the Biona wetlands. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jane, very much. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is America's Green Corps.
Okay, good morning.
It appears that America's Green Corps is using an older version of Zoom, and I'm not able to give them permission to unmute.
Okay, Katie. How about our next speaker then?
For our next speaker, let's try the call-in number ending in 983 again.
Okay, good morning. Katie, is there another speaker after the caller?
Yes, yeah, it appears that the audio is not working for 983.
Okay.
We also had on the list our speaker.
Okay, somebody's just joined. This is the caller. Oh. Okay. Hello.
Hi, this is 5983.
Yes, you are on.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that.
If you'll state your name for the record, that would be great.
Yes, it's Patricia Miller, and I live in Lakehead, California. I've been working with Randy Collins on some adjacent land that you guys were trying to get someone to come in and clean up the burnt forest timberland. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from Randy, who's done everything in his power, I think, to try and get this accomplished. And he had a contractor that was willing to do it, but the bid apparently is too high. So I don't know how we're going to move forward because I've already got trees falling on our land, pretty large tree, one already. And I know there's going to be many more because there's thousands of trees there. So I don't know what the plan is to move forward. What are we supposed to do? I mean, I'm 66, my husband's 60. These trees are not something we can physically just cut up and haul and put in piles and burn. And I don't know what to do. I don't know where we are at this point. And I'm a little disheartened because he told me the next call I would get was the start date, you know, and now it's been declined as too expensive. And I don't know where we go from here. So I'd like you to give me some advice on what to do with the dead trees when it is already fallen. And in the future, how am I supposed to dispose of them? What am I supposed to do here? I just need some advice.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. We will have somebody contact you. Ms. Lucchese, do you want to address that?
Yes, I'm happy to address that, and we'll continue to work with Ms. Miller, and I'm grateful that she called in today. We have had challenges, as the commission knows, because we've talked about this on in terms of getting estimates and a contractor out there to conduct debris and tree and shrub removal, vegetation removal. The only estimate that we have received is approximately $450,000 to clear 4 acres. And as part of our due diligence as a fiduciary of these state funds, we have been ground truthing essentially that estimate. And we continue to do so with our partner agency, CAL FIRE. So, you know, I know that this is incredibly frustrating for Ms. Miller. We're thankful for her patience, but we're still working through the cost estimate, looking at what our options are, and really trying to tap into our partner agencies who have a lot more expertise, particularly when it comes to cost estimates relating to this kind of work in this kind of remote area with this type of terrain. So I would just encourage Ms. Miller to continue to be patient. I know that's hard, but we are continuing to work through this challenging issue.
Thank you, Ms. Lucchese, and thank you, Ms. Miller, for bringing the issue forward, and we will continue working with you to get it resolved. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is someone calling in with the last three digits, 084.
Good morning. Is our caller?
Yes, I can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Okay. Hello and season's greetings. Vice President Harris, California State Lands Commission, Tribal Council leaders, people of the Central Coast, and the University of California. My name is Ryan Davis, and I am the author of the unpublished America's Green Reconstruction Plan, creator of Project First Light Lab, and founder of America's Green Corps 501c3. We are a newly incorporated California-rooted not-for-profit. It is our mission to bridge the fossil fuel industry with our construction of the renewable grid. In doing this, we will guide the big wheel onto a sustainable course and onward to starry horizons. Quick story. When I first arrived to Santa Barbara, I explored the treasure of the Painted Cave, where I became captivated by the symbols painted by the Chumash visionary. I saw the black and white sails of a ship, a radiant sun, the cog of a wheel, and web. To me, the message was clear. This shaman understood the forces of nature that power the Central Coast. This moment of revelation inspired me to begin designing America's Green Reconstruction Plan along the Central Coast. For our pilot project, we are commissioning the transformation of Platform Holly into the Kutosh Lighthouse Maritime Monument, the beacon of the West. The redesign will significantly reduce seepage, improve public safety, and create a catalyst for aquaculture, which filters and oxygenates the water. It will become an iconic attraction for Santa Barbara County and maritime tourism. It is our intention for this to be a gift to the Chumash and pay tribute to those who served on the front lines. This monument and its construction shape the narrative of metamorphosis for our aging oil infrastructure. We seek the Tribal Council's blessing and California State Lands Commission's approval for the course of action, which we outlined in the art and science proposal submitted in August of 2020. Additionally, we are requesting letters of support from community leaders, Governor Gavin Newsom, and those who have services they may contribute to the development of this monumental endeavor. Let's put the star on top of the holly tree. Thank you, happy holidays, and contact us at projectfirstlight.net. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Katie, our next caller.
Thank you, Katie. At this time, we have no other hands raised for general public comment.
Okay. Thank you very much for managing our callers. We will have another opportunity for a public comment for items not on the agenda at the end of our open session today. So let's, members, move on to the next item of business, which is the adoption of the minutes of the commission's meeting of October 22nd, 2020. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Move approval, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Miller. Seconded by Commissioner Kunalakis. Ms. Lucchese, please call the roll.
Certainly. Commissioner Kunalakis.
Aye.
Commissioner Miller.
Aye.
Chair Yee.
Aye.
The motion passes unanimously.
Great. Thank you very much. Our next order of business is the executive officer's report. Ms. Lucchese, may we have the report?
Certainly. I'm happy to provide that report. I will start providing a brief update of our decommissioning projects. The commission continues to make progress in abandoning the wells at the former Rincon leases. On the island, 46 of the 50 wells have been plugged, and onshore, we continue 24 of the 25 wells, which have been abandoned. Altogether, we have completed 93% of the well abandonments, and project completion is expected by June of next year. Total project costs are estimated at $38.6 million, which is $4.4 million or 10.2% below initial estimates. In September of this year, the commission released a solicitation for an environmental consultant to conduct a feasibility study and prepare CEQA documentation to evaluate decommissioning alternatives for the disposition of the island, the onshore facility, and the causeway. 8 highly qualified firms submitted responses, and we have interviewed 4 of the most qualified candidates and selected a contractor. This work will begin in the first quarter of 2021 and is anticipated to be completed in 2022. This process will include extensive public outreach and stakeholder engagement. Platform Holly plug-in abandonment work remains suspended due to COVID-19 restrictions and space limitations on the platform that limit physical distancing practices. Staff continues to maintain and monitor the platform and onshore facilities to ensure public health and safety. ExxonMobil and Commission staff, in conjunction with the City of Goleta, are developing a project description to decommission the oil piers associated with lease number RC 421 to begin the CEQA process. The Commission will be the CEQA lead agency and applicant for the project. The CEQA process will also include robust stakeholder engagement and is anticipated to take about 12 months to complete. Staff and its contractors continue to take unused processing equipment out of service at the Elwood Processing Facility in order to reduce costs. And finally, permission to cross private property to access the state's Elwood Pier, which is used to transport equipment and personnel to Platform Holly, ceased on December 1st when the access agreement with the surface landowner and ExxonMobil expired. The pier, as I mentioned, is used to transport personnel and supplies and to evacuate personnel if there is an emergency at the platform. Both ExxonMobil and Commission operations have relocated to other operating piers in the Santa Barbara Channel, while negotiations on a new access agreement for Elwood Pier continue. This SB 44 Legacy Wells and Coastal Hazards Program provides $2 million per year to address legacy wells and coastal hazards. The Commission successfully plugged and abandoned 2 wells offshore Summerlin in November. Post-abandonment monitoring has shown a visible improvement in beach conditions. Summerlin residents and other members of the public have expressed their gratitude to the Commission for our continuing efforts to remediate this decades-old environmental problem. Staff plan to abandon 2 more wells next year and look forward to continued work with our partner agencies and the community. Also in November, the Commission and its contractor removed hazards on behalf of the City of Goleta, including 15 pipeline segments that were exposed along the beach because of eroding bluffs. Next, I want to move up the coast to the City of Marina. The CEMEX Coastal Sand Mining Plant facility in Marina has stopped its mining operations. The CEMEX facility had operated since the early 1960s and was responsible for some of the highest levels of beach erosion anywhere in California. The mining diminished public trust resources and values such as beach recreation, conservation, and public access. After a coalition of scientists, environmental groups, and residents raised significant concerns, the State Lands Commission and the Coastal Commission investigated the operation and reached a settlement in partnership with the City of Marina with CEMEX in 2017 to cease active sand mining by December 31st of this year. The Commission is pleased that CEMEX honored the agreement and ceased operations earlier than expected. Under the settlement, the next steps include processing stockpiled sand, initiation of a mine reclamation plan, and conveyance of the property to a nonprofit or governmental entity that commits to managing the property primarily for conservation and access purposes. Next, I want to move on to our renewable energy applications for offshore Vandenberg. Staff continues to process 2 offshore wind applications for the use of tide and submerged lands in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Vandenberg Air Force Base. Staff is performing a combination of an early public consultation and scoping approach with some project analysis substance of an initial study. This approach will provide preliminary insight on affected resources to help guide early public input on the notice of preparation scoping process for preparation of an EIR. We also hosted our first stakeholder outreach webinar on December 8th. Over 170 individuals attended, representing elected officials, state and federal agencies, tribal representatives, environmental groups, academia, building industry and workforce, fisheries, and ports. A panel of commission staff provided an overview and background application process, differences between federal and state offshore wind projects, and technical details on the two proposed projects. The panel then facilitated an interactive question and answer session with participants. Staff will continue to respond to questions raised during the webinar that were unanswered due to time limitations. The webinar was recorded and will be posted on our website along with our PowerPoint presentation. Staff will conduct additional, smaller, and more focused outreach sessions in January and through April of next year. And finally, I want to acknowledge and celebrate a number of retirements that the State Lands Commission is currently facing at the end of this year. It is that time of year where the state experiences a number of retirements, especially from career public servants who have dedicated their lives to serving the people of California. We have been celebrating such public servants at other agencies that we work closely with and who we feel are extended members of our own State Lands family, including Steve Hampton at Fish and Wildlife's OSPR, Pat Abel at CalGEM, and Susan Hanch and Jeff Staben at the Coastal Commission. Here at State Lands, we are also celebrating a number of family members and their retirements. First, I want to talk about our division chief of our Mineral Resources Management Division, Marina Voskanian. Marina has provided the people of California with nearly 34 years of dedicated and distinguished public service. After receiving her Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering in 1974, Marina earned her Master of Science degree in Petroleum Engineering in 1976 and her PhD in Petroleum Engineering in 1978. She became a registered professional petroleum engineer and spent 12 years in the private sector of the oil and gas industry before entering state service as an engineer with the commission in 1987. Marina, since 1987, has provided expert technical and program analysis and recommendations, initially as a petroleum reservoir engineer, then as a chief reservoir engineer, and then promoting up to the chief of our planning and development unit, and finally as an assistant division chief in the Mineral Resources Management Division in 2009. In 2012, Marina Voskanian served as the first woman to earn the position of chief of the Mineral Resources Management Division of the Commission. Marina has ably guided the Commission's Mineral Resources Management Division staff and programs with her expertise, professionalism, judgment, empathy, and leadership. Through her effective skills and technical expertise, she directed the efficient, safe, and environmentally responsible development of the state's mineral resources. She has guided the division's transformation and evolution from a focus on hydrocarbon resource development to expanded renewable resource programs, including offshore wind. While managing the state's mineral resources, Marina has maintained and provided the highest level environmental protection and public safety, all while generating over $4 billion to the state's general fund during her 34 years with the commission. In addition to being the first female chief of the Mineral Resources Management Division at the Commission, Marina has kept abreast of the advances of the petroleum technology through her longtime participation in the professional society of the Society of Petroleum Engineers. And she served as the first female Los Angeles Basin section chair of the society. She was also the first woman to hold the regional directorship position of the International Society of Petroleum Engineering, representing California and Alaska. And she has received numerous national and international recognition awards. She was also elected Distinguished Lecturer 4 times by the Society of Petroleum Engineers and was invited to give lectures in 34 countries promoting the Commission's safety and pollution prevention programs. Succeeded in compiling an impressive record of career achievements, earning her the admiration and respect of her peers, those who have had the privilege of working with her, and also of those representing opposing interests. Marina is an incredible leader, smart, thoughtful, strategic, kind, and dedicated. And I'm so grateful to have been able to learn from her over these past 20 years. And personally, I'm eternally grateful for her mentorship, patience with my own oil and gas learning curve, and friendship. She will be missed by all of us. And I want to commend and thank her for her distinguished record of professional public service for nearly 34 years serving the commission. I have a couple more to get through, so be patient with me. Our next retirement celebration acknowledgement is Denise Cook. Denise Cook has served the commission since 2001 and the state of California since 1989. And due to her leadership, expertise, and commitment to the commission, she was appointed chief of the commission's administrative services division in 2018. So here, and she was also the first female to be appointed chief to this division as well. And so just as a note, I think it's really incredible that we're celebrating these two pioneer women in their own fields with a commission that is also its membership of all females as well. Through Denise's empathetic, positive reinforcement, and quiet confidence leadership styles, Denise maintained the highest level of fiscal integrity for the commission. And through her determined involvement and persistent advocacy, she has been instrumental in implementing the state's extremely complex fiscal program at the commission. And Denise, during the height of the COVID pandemic, volunteered her leadership skills to direct a group of contact tracers in this invaluable effort, which really speaks to her kindness, dedication to public service, and willingness to help her fellow Californians. Denise has succeeded in compiling an impressive record of career achievements as well, earning her also the admiration and respect of all who have had the privilege of working with her. Next, I want to acknowledge and celebrate Greg Pelka. Greg was initially hired with the state and the commission in 1982 as an energy and mineral resources engineer. He was promoted to a senior mineral resources engineer in 1997 and has served the commission over 38 years. Greg is an incredibly kind, smart, thoughtful, and very and dedicated public servant to the commission. He has really led the effort in building our abandoned mines program in coordination and partnership with the Department of Conservation. His work over the many decades on our abandoned mines program has literally saved lives. I will never forget one of the times that I was able to accompany Greg on a trip to look at some of the mines, abandoned mines that he was looking to remediate and really get a handle on the work that he does every day. We stayed at Buffalo Bill's in Prim, Nevada, and traipsed around the hillsides and the mountains of San Bernardino County for a couple of days. Greg is just one of those salt of the earth, genuine, patient people. And the people of California are just so lucky that he worked over 38 years to really make the lands that the commission has jurisdiction over safer for all of those adventurous and outdoor enthusiasts to traipse around and explore California's desert. I want to commend and thank Greg for his distinguished record of professional public service serving the commission over the past 38 years. And finally, I want to acknowledge and celebrate Barry Shuffles. After joining the commission in December of 2006, Barry has spent the following 14 years as a valued member of our Southern California Field Office Field Inspection staff. Barry has been able to utilize a lot of maritime experience in ensuring full and insightful inspections, having worked for 23 years at Crowley Maritime before coming to the commission. Barry has always been conscientious about all of his duties at state lands, ensuring he was always positive in his approach to our work and a joy to work with for both the regulated community as well as his colleagues at the commission. And I also want to just say a note about the work of our inspectors. From the beginning of the pandemic, the oil and gas industry, from production and development to transportation, was considered an essential service. And our inspectors did not miss a beat in terms of inspecting and monitoring transfers of petroleum product through our marine oil terminals, or inspecting and monitoring offshore facilities. And they can, even with the concerns around the transmission of COVID, are dedicated to ensuring the public's health and safety and protection of the marine environment during the past 8 months. So retirements like Marina's, Denise's, Greg's, and Barry's are always so bittersweet. We are sad to know that we won't be able to work with our incredible colleagues every day on important commission projects, but we are extremely happy and excited for them to embark on this new phase of their life and know they will enjoy their well-deserved retirement and make the most of the next adventure in their life. We'll be saying goodbye to valuable and dedicated employees and we'll miss them greatly. And I speak for all of Commission staff in wishing Marina, Denise, Greg, and Barry the best in their future adventures and thank them for their outstanding work and dedication to the Commission and the people of California. And if it is okay with the chair, I would love to turn it over to Marina Voskanian just to say a couple of words.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jennifer, for the report. Good morning, Marina.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for this recognition and your kind words, Jennifer, and all the commissioners. I'm proud and honored to have served the State Lands Commission governance and state leadership provided by you and the past commissioners during my career. I'm grateful that I have worked under the leadership and professionalism of our executive officer, Jennifer Lucchesi. Fortunate and blessed to have leaders that work hard to protect the state's resources and environment, and I'm grateful I have been a part of that legacy. I will cherish the memories and friendship I made over the years with the Commission and wish you continued success with all your important programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Marina, and all best wishes to you. Thank you so much for your service to the Commission and to the people of California. Thank you, Ms. Lucchesi, for the report. Let me turn to Commissioners Kunalakis and Miller to see if there are any comments or questions.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's always very inspiring to have these recognitions of people who have worked in service to the state for most, if not all, of their career. And that as they close this chapter and go on to whatever it is that awaits them in their retirement, we take a pause and recognize how important public service is, how important things that the public may have forgotten or may never even have known about the incredibly hard work that all of our staff here puts in every day. And Marina, as you were talking, I couldn't help but think of how many lieutenant governors you've seen come through the State Lands Commission over the years. And through it all, you and Denise and Barry and Greg, you have given it your all and dedicated your lives in service to the state of California. And Marina, looking behind you at that beautiful image of our coast, you know, it's clear what your mission has been. And of course, you're not the only one to have that picture behind, of course, at State Lands, but it really says it all. And so for your tireless work, you know, I'm sorry that we're not all together so we can share a couple of cupcakes, maybe a glass of bubbly, Jennifer, I don't know. But at least virtually in this setting to be able to take this moment to recognize you, to thank you, and to really attempt in this, you know, moment to understand and help the public understand how incredibly important your work is. Again, even to things that they may never know who's behind it, but when they go to a beach or they go to our coastline or in the multitude of other ways that the state lands protects our beautiful environment, our beautiful coast, that there are people every day toiling away to do the hard work. So thank you all. And I hope that your next chapter is full of some great hikes and the ability to experience the incredible environment that you have helped to steward during your careers.
Thank you, Commissioner Kunalakis. Really wonderful words. Commissioner Miller, comment?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just also sharing all my very best and gratitude for your service. It's really an inspiration to see a career of such incredible public service and one with such humility and grace. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Miller. And let me add my congratulations to Marina and to Denise and Greg and to Barry as well. I think the word that Commissioner Miller just used that will always stay with me of all of the commission staff is humility. We do this work under sometimes some very extraordinary circumstances, but it is about just really making a contribution. And I hope you all feel just very rewarded by the fact that you're leaving very lasting legacies with the work that you've done for the people of California. And so we're so, so appreciative. Thank you. And to Marina, thank you. You've been a mentor of mine from afar. So really appreciate all of your work. Ms. Lucchese, I have to just say, obviously this all happens with leadership from the top in terms of the culture that you've been able to instill in this organization. And I think that certainly comes through with respect to the work that gets accomplished. And I just wanted to just add my thanks for the plugging of the abandoned wells and just the tremendous work that's gone into that and the wonderful progress that we're making to have that initiative come in under cost and to have the kind of progress that we're seeing is just really nothing short of remarkable, particularly during this time when that work needs to continue under some limitations. And then very, very proud of the action that this commission took in partnership with our sister agencies relative to the ceasing of sand mining by CEMEX. This is really a historic moment, and certainly for our communities on the Monterey Central Coast. This has been a long time coming. So thank you for the sustained attention to this and really, I think, a cause for celebration. Thank you very much. Okay. We'll now move on to our next order of business, which will be the adoption of the consent calendar. Commissioners Kunalakis or Miller, any items that you would like removed from the consent calendar?
No.
Okay. Next, let me call on Ms. Lucchese to indicate which items, if any, have been removed from the consent calendar.
Certainly. Consent items 16, 23, and 50 are removed from the agenda and will be considered at a later time. And that concludes the removal of any items from the agenda.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me just now turn to see if there's anyone joining us virtually who wishes to speak on any item remaining on the consent calendar. Items 16, 23, and 50 have been removed to be considered for a later time. If we do have anyone who wishes to speak on the remaining items, please raise your Zoom hand or dial 9 if joining by phone now. And Katie, let me just look to you to see if there are any speakers.
Hey, Cherry. We have Patricia McPherson who would like to speak.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning. My name is Patricia McPherson. I'm president of Grassroots Coalition and State Lands Commission. I was glad to hear about the abandoned well information, and I would just like to remind everyone that there is State Lands Commission has property located in Biona Wetlands Ecological Reserve that has a well that is currently leaking, known as University City Syndicate. And I would just like to draw your attention to this area that is public trust land, but is stewarded by the State Lands Commission, which is also known as the Freshwater Marsh in Biona Wetlands. And I just wanted to draw that to your attention. Grassroots Coalition has been working with the State Water Board. We've brought in experts that were the former City of LA experts for oil and gas issues that have raised a red flag regarding this well and the dangers it poses. And we'd just like to have assistance from the State Lands Commission in addressing this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Katie, let me just see if there are any other speakers for items that are remaining on the consent agenda.
Yes, thank you, Chair Yi. We have our next speaker. Oh, they've lowered their hand.
Okay. Any other speakers?
Thank you, Chair Yi. At this time, we have no other hands raised.
Thank you, Katie. All right. Seeing no other hands raised, we will now proceed with the vote. May I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda in a second?
So moved.
Okay. Moved by Commissioner Kunalakis. I will second that motion. And Mr. Casey, please call the roll.
Certainly. Commissioner Kunalakis.
Aye.
Commissioner Miller. Chair Yi.
Aye.
The motion passes.
Here comes Commissioner Miller.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
May I vote, please? Aye. Thank you. My apologies, Madam Chair.
No problem.
The motion passes unanimously.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. Let's move on to the next order of business, which will be the regular calendar. Item 60 is an informational update on efforts to develop the Commission's 2021 to 2025 strategic plan. May we have the presentation?
Yes, Katie Robinson-Phillip from our staff will be introducing this item, followed by Lisa Butler with Stantec, and her Katie's presentation or their collective presentation should be being loaded now.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners. My name is Katie Robinson-Phillip, and I'm an environmental scientist at the Commission. This year, the Commission has worked with a consultant, Stantec, to develop an aspirational and forward-looking 2021-2025 strategic plan. Together, Commission staff and Stantec have coordinated a comprehensive and inclusive engagement outreach effort to inform the development of the draft plan, including an extensive series of stakeholder interviews representing various areas of interest and a series of tribal engagement roundtable sessions and individual consultations. Additionally, the consultant facilitated a workshop with senior commission management to solicit their input on the trends, issues, and priorities that will affect the commission's work over the next 5 to 10 years. Commission staff have worked with the consultant to incorporate the input and feedback from these engagement efforts into an initial draft of the 2021-2025 strategic plan, which is now available for public review. The development of the strategic plan is an iterative process, and staff looks forward to receiving feedback and additional perspectives, ideas, and comments on the current draft strategic plan. Today, Lisa Butler from Stantec will present an overview of the structure and content for the 2021-2025 draft strategic plan, followed by an update from Executive Officer Jennifer Lucchesi on next steps before opening for comments and questions. And now I'd like to welcome Lisa to provide her presentation, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Okay, we'll go to the next slide, please. So, my name's Lisa Butler, and I was very honored to lead the consultant team for this document. As a reminder, we pulled together quite a few people that represented a lot of different interests in preparing this plan. As Katie mentioned, we talked to senior staff. Another thing that we did was go back and look at your commission meeting notes, and we reviewed speeches that many of you made, and you are wonderful speakers that have spoken in a number of formats. So we went back and took a look at that. Our goal was to prepare a plan that would be very faithful to what we heard and would represent what we thought was the overall ethic that of the commission itself. So moving to the next slide. This is how the plan is actually structured. We prepared an executive highlights. This is a smaller document that would be easy to pull out. We're very appreciative of the fact that that may be the only thing that anybody actually reads because of the size of the plan. So our goal here was to synthesize what was there, make it easy to read, and we would really be looking for comments about that to help us make sure we hit all the right points, as well as that we were able to properly synthesize and make it accessible in terms of reading. The plan then breaks a little bit into a traditional strategic planning structure, which talks about who you are, where you've been, the drivers of change, what you're called to do, and the strategic focus areas and goals. We would offer that there may be some that would be hoping for very specific items to be included in this plan. And that's really not the intention of this plan. The goal of this plan is to set forward a direction and drive to the future. We believe it's going to be important for the commission to spend time with very deliberative time with some of the things that were asked to be included, that wasn't really the role of a strategic plan to do that. We also heard from staff that we're looking forward to doing some specific things. And what the strategic focus areas do and what staff will be, the senior leadership of the organization will be doing, is coming back to you with work plans and different kinds of goals each year to talk about how you're going to move forward to make progress in the strategic focus areas. So I'm now cover very quickly the various parts of the plan. Next slide, please. So first part is the who we are. It talks about what the commission's responsibilities are, the vision, values, and guiding principles. And to the next slide. So in understanding what the commission's values are, this is basically a statement of your culture, of who you are, what you represent. And so people know when they're interacting with the commission, these are the kinds of things that they can expect. This is the way that the commission intends to be present in the world. The next slide talks about the principles. The guiding principles are the ways that you make decisions, the way you shape the culture. It's essentially a form of a report card. So for every decision that comes in front of the commission, there is an understanding that we've evaluated the health and safety, that we've looked at stewardship, that there is accountability, that there's integrity, there's been engagement, people have been incorporated, their quality and very solution-oriented. So it's a way of doing things. The next slide talks about what we heard from people that we talked to. So here we heard about climate change and sea level rise. We heard a lot about environmental, economic, and social injustice and the need to address that. Some really wonderful comments that came forward from the government-to-government consultations and conversations that staff held with tribal governments about self-governance and self-determination. A lot of heartfelt discussion about the public trust principles and really in-depth thinking about what happens in a post-petroleum era. So the drivers of change are described and summarized in the plan just to help people understand what it is that is really pushing you towards the future. So the next item in the plan is the call to action. So based on what we heard, we were able to capture what it is that you've been asked to do. And clearly, there's never been a time where the path forward has been more challenging. There's a need to address climate change. There's a need to take a look at social and environmental justice, looking at ways to navigate the economy, especially adjusting to a pandemic, and the unyielding need for stewardship and conservation of the public lands. So you've decidedly been called forward to take a look and take a path that will achieve the right endpoint. The next space, the next slide. We also heard that you've been called to action in a time where swift change is required. The demands for communication, elevation, and responding to every level of experience are forward for you. You know you can make changes. You know you can protect the environment and grow the economy. These are not mutually exclusive. These are things that can be done as an and both. You know that you can uplift and empower communities and provide more equitable realities and brighter futures for everyone. Something that was exciting to us as we talked to people, there is a collective vocabulary that has grown. We are now talking collectively about inclusivity, about equitably, diversity, accessibility, sustainability, collaboration, and innovation. So the next slide. So the next thing that the document does is says, here's what you're called to do, and here's how you can put it together. These are cross-cutting issues. There are a lot of things that you can do that one part will help inform another part. So this is how do we put it together, and seven specific ideas we'll pull together about how to do that. I'll discuss them in order. So moving to the next slide. So the first one is leading climate activism. The climate change is clearly threatening people. The highlights are that this plan really puts forth ideas about proactively addressing climate change by leveraging lands under its jurisdiction and partnering, collaborating, and engaging with the sister agencies. Some of the features of this particular section of the document is about justly transitioning activities, that there is a need to move out of the petroleum-based activities, carbon emissions. There are ways to move to carbon neutral and renewable energy options to actually contribute positively to new ways of revenue and energy generation. Also, an ability for you to do carbon sequestration and actually look at emission reduction strategies. The part about partnering talks about the need for unified and coordinated action and policies across all of the state's agencies. And this is a leadership role that we heard was very important from the other agencies, that they felt that the commission could really take a big role here. We also heard, and we believe that there's an interest on the behalf of the commission of considering options for climate refugees. I think we even heard a speaker earlier during the public comment of people who are experiencing consequences from climate change that are quite dramatic. We have a need for climate resilient green infrastructure, and there are lots of ways to do co-management, which are very exciting. The next item talks about social and economic and environmental justice. And for here, what we wanted to highlight was the way to proactively incorporate correction of historic actions. So this is not just a go forward, but a look back as well. There is inequity that is based in past practices, and there may be a way for the commission to really get in front of that and talk about a different way of doing things that can bring some form of equity to what's happened in the past. The center point of this particular activity is inclusion. That there's a need to bring people in and have them be part of the process of thinking about what should happen. So rather than things being done on behalf of or for or to people, that they are co-creating what that outcome might be. We also know that there are ways that you can do decision making that will lower talent virus screen scores so that they have less impact on communities, and that there's a great opportunity for rethinking the way the lands are managed to create more ownership for the communities in which they occur. The next item talks about partnering with tribal governments and communities. The foundation of this particular area of the plan is respect. There is a rich understanding on the behalf of the commission about the traditional ecological knowledge and the kinds of information and thoughtfulness that the tribal peoples are able to bring to decision making, and the great relationship of the land and the commission that can be evolved through the relationship with the tribes. The next item has to do with meeting evolving public trust needs. This may be a little bit surprising, the way that we have addressed this or approaches. It's really grounded in the idea of communication, outreach, and co-creation. So rather than laying out specific types of things that the trust should do, one thing that we heard from the public when we talked to them about this is people don't really understand the trust, and they don't really understand the rich heritage that the trust brings. And so they're not operating in a way that is enhancing to the trust. So this section really focuses on ways of organizing and interacting with others to really extend that. Another thing that we heard was really important to people was creating new kinds of partnerships with institutions and organizations to extend what's possible to do with the trust and the trust lands. So the next one after that is all about leveraging technology. And there are lots of traditional things that we always hear about, you know, getting our data systems in place. There's real interest, though, in improving the decision support, a very heightened understanding of the kinds of needs to improve security and risk management. Technology can certainly bring us efficiency. One of the things, though, that really jumped out, particularly in this time of a pandemic, is how technology can change the way that we interact with others, that we're going to now be allowed to be in different kinds of meetings. We had a speaker already mention this, how much they appreciated the fact that they could attend this meeting when maybe in the past they couldn't have. It's also changed the way that staff can interact with others throughout the organization. So a lot of focus to that and a real focus to enhancing the decision support and data functions of the commission. The next one is commitment to collaborative leadership. This is what we heard over and over again, and we've mentioned this to you previously, about the great desire of the other agencies to look to you to provide leadership that pulls together all of the other agencies, that you have this amazing ability to serve as the convener and mediator of planning and policy dialogues, that you're able to bring in multidisciplinary approaches, and that you're able to help set the stage and on a much greater basis than any other agencies really able to do. So it's a call to you, a request, a call for action from the others for you to be able to take this role. They also, we heard that there's just a real need to continue and model what you've done so well, stakeholder and public engagement, that you have been able to institutionalize this relationship. And something that's been important to you and you've been able to do quite well is move this beyond just an individual relationship with one person on the staff or somebody that somebody knows, but broadly across the entire commission, that that everyone understands it's the commission itself that is advocating for this relationship and engagement. And then finally, the last item is building a reimagined workforce. We've already heard that there are people retiring. We heard wonderful things about the Lands Commission staff, and it was just across the board. The only time we ever heard anything that was even remotely negative had to do with people not about the commission being asked to do something that it wasn't really organized to do. So there are certain kinds of decision sets or spans of control that the commission has. And sometimes people couldn't quite figure out how to interface because there wasn't a program or something in the commission that did it. It always got resolved. I see Jennifer actually nodding her head. It gets resolved because, you know, Jennifer and Colin and everybody put their head together and figure out, oh, how are we going to do this? Where does this go? So one of the things that the executive team has been looking at is kind of reimagining how they might be structured to better do that, to get those work streams that are more reflective of the new work that you know is going to be coming to you. And also take a look at succession management. I mean, I don't know how you replace some of the people that we heard about today. They're so amazing. And you must. So this is a little bit about how the team is going to be doing that. Something that was really that people were passionate about and we were excited about when we met with the senior team was this idea that that solutions and responses should not be siloed. People wanted multidisciplinary approaches. Even counsel of the legal team was hopping in. There's ways that everyone could work together to make sure that things were done and improve efficiency. So people actually really helping each other rather than having things happen in silos. And the last one is kind of an interesting one, but everyone was really committed to removing or eliminating bottlenecks. So with that, I have done a very fast tour of a relatively long document. Once again, I do appreciate there were people that had really hoped to see very specific items included in this plan, and they're not there. I hope that our reasoning is understandable. I do believe that we heard a lot of good ideas, and they deserve deliberation. They just don't have a specific action item in this plan. And I'll turn this to the executive officer.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. And thank you to your entire team for the presentation and the hard work on developing this draft strategic plan. Our staff has worked with StanTech to incorporate the input, ideas, and comments from the stakeholder and tribal engagement and public meetings and comments over the past 8 months into this draft plan presented today. This is a working draft, and we are committed to being responsive to the input and comments from the continuing engagement process. I really look at this as StanTech and our team did a tremendous amount of work to engage our stakeholders, to engage our partners and our staff. Now we're at ground truthing, the ground truthing stage, where we have a draft document and people have something to react to, and we can continue this really robust and rich conversation about where we might have gotten it right and where we got it wrong and how we going forward. So again, I don't want anybody listening or watching this to think that we're at the end of the process. We are right smack in the middle of it, where we should be, in really understanding and gaining a deeper understanding of input and perspectives, and trying to understand where all of our stakeholders are coming from. So we really encourage everyone to continue to share their voice, their insight and experience as we work to refine this plan. And obviously on the screen, you can see how folks can, or maybe the screen is done now. So you can provide suggestions by phone or by email. All of that information is on our website. And we are happy to answer any questions that the commissioners may have at this point, or even after some of the public comment is shared. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lucchese. Thank you, Lisa and to Katie and to the team for really taking all of the input and developing this framework, which is, as Ms. Lucchese has pointed out, we're kind of midway in our process and definitely still want to hear from everyone. Let me turn to Commissioners Kunalakis and Miller to see if there are any questions or comments at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, just really briefly, this has been a very important ongoing effort, and it looks as though we're going to be continuing with it into the new year. So, Madam Chair, thank you for your origination of the strategic plan, your stewardship over the last year. And I think it's important to underscore, as Ms. Lucchese noted, that we're going to continue to take input, and we have more work to do into 2021.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Commissioner Kunalakis. Commissioner Miller, any comment? No? Okay, thank you. First, let me just say, really wonderful, wonderful document. And again, I know we've been hearing from some of the stakeholders about specific issues, and I just want to also reiterate that these issues are not being ignored. I think this framework actually is very accommodating in terms of just some of the more specific things that are being raised. And so none of what is being brought before this commission will be ignored by any means. And I just appreciate the proactiveness and the just necessarily future orientation of the document, understanding that things around us are evolving, and particularly, first and foremost, our charge of being really the stewards of the public trust, and how there are going to be many, many more demands and certainly areas of focus that we are going to be tasked with having to consider. And so to just recognize that upfront as part of our framework, I'm just really appreciative of. So let me turn to Katie and see if we have any public comments on this item. And if anyone wishes to comment, please raise your Zoom hand now. And Katie, I'm going to help you. I know there are speakers for this item, so if you'll just start calling them one at a time.
Thank you, Chair Yee. The first person making comment on this item is Jason Giffen.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Jason.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Yee, Commissioners, Executive Officer Lucchese, and staff. My name is Jason Giffen, and I'm a Vice President for the Port of San Diego. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide public comment on this important item. As a grantee of state lands, a self-sustaining public benefit corporation and regional government entity, the Port is appreciative of the statewide coordination the Commission and your staff have implemented as you look to update your strategic plan. Both our CEO, Randa Coniglio, and Job Nelson, our Chief Policy Officer, have been directly involved and contributed to the process so far. We are grateful for your genuine interest in supporting ports and harbors, as well as the communities and stakeholders we serve. Specifically, I'd like to also thank Chair Yee and Ms. Lucchese for your recent visit to the Port of San Diego, where you were able to see firsthand how our port operations and projects are continuing to provide public benefits despite our long list of current challenges. We view the State Lands Commission as one of our most valuable partners, and strategic alignment is the X factor in our shared success. We have developed productive working relationships over the years that have contributed to our shared success, whether it be through projects like the San Diego Ocean Planning Partnership led by Chair Yi's vision, or supporting innovations like the Port's Blue Economy Incubator, proving to be just one catalyst that's helping drive our blue economy through public-private partnerships that support projects and investments to restore our environment, support emerging marine technology and infrastructure solutions, or otherwise contribute to improve public benefits in and around our tidelands and submerged lands. We were happy to participate in the outreach in your first strategic plan, and now to be a part of the development of the second iteration. As chronicled in your staff report, we too are seeing demand for our responsibilities and missions broadening, whether it be related to climate change or coastal resilience, financial sustainability, equity and environmental justice, or the evolution of public benefits under the public trust. We are witnessing similar trends to the ones you were discovering through the strategic planning process, and we appreciate your support as we collectively strive to tackle complex issues and balance our public trust responsibilities together. We look forward to continuing our partnership with the Commission and your staff, and to facilitate and promote responsible maritime commerce, navigation, trade, and waterfront revitalization, while also supporting recreation and environmental stewardship. We thank you for today's update, led by Executive Officer Lucchese and her staff, and we will be sure to provide you with some thoughtful written comments on the draft document in the coming weeks. Thank you very much, and that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Jason, very much for your comments. Katie, our next speaker.
Yes, our next speaker is Jeff Boehm.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Chair Yi, commissioners, and Executive Officer Lucchese. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment before the commission this morning. My name is Dr. Jeff Boehm, and I am the Chief Executive Officer at the Marine Mammal Center. I want to thank the commission for addressing seabed mining in its draft strategic plan as a strong first step towards developing real and meaningful policies and regulations on this issue. This offers promise for precautionary actions that will safeguard marine mammals, other marine wildlife, and the ocean ecosystem. I'm trained as a veterinarian and have served as the CEO of the Marine Mammal Center now since 2008. The Marine Mammal Center is the world's largest marine mammal teaching hospital, treating hundreds of marine mammal patients each year, and as such is an ocean conservation organization with a global impact. We train as many as 100 future marine mammal veterinarians and biologists each year, and have cared for more than 24,000 marine mammal patients during our 45-year history. We learn from every patient in our care about their health, the health of their species and their ocean home, and about the connection to human health. We are on the front lines of ocean change and are witness to the many stressors that marine mammals face along the California coast. Our patients present malnourished from inadequate or displaced food sources, suffering from infections and toxins, entangled in fishing lines and marine debris, and dying from cancer at a rate that is extraordinary among wildlife species. In 2014, in a statement of evidence on the application of a firm seeking rights to mine seabeds in the coastal waters of New Zealand, an Otago University associate professor shared the following. The potential impacts of the proposed mining on marine mammals include collisions with vessels and mining equipment, habitat degradation, noise, and pollution, including increased availability of toxins in the seabed due to the mining activity. The potential ecological effects include impacts of the proposed mining on benthic organisms, which affect higher trophic levels, including fish densities and or movements, which in turn may affect prey availability for marine mammals. These impacts are predicted to occur within the mining area itself, as well as in the downstream sediment plume area. Our marine mammals in California don't need these additional threats. Our collective action should be focused on securing a healthy ocean habitat for these species and the myriad other species that live in coastal waters of California and rely on their health. An enormous tourism and fishery economy depend on the same. An oft-cited pledge among medical professionals is to first do no harm. The California State Lands Commission ought to be guided by the same counsel as it refines its strategic plan. In consideration of seabed mining, I urge the commission to continue with the steps it has begun to develop a strong policy framework, potentially leading to a prohibition on seabed mining. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for your comments. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Courtney Vail.
Good morning, Courtney.
Good morning. Good morning, esteemed commissioners. I am Courtney Vail, campaign director at Oceanic Preservation Society based in Green Bay in Marin County. I thank you for this additional opportunity to address the commission on the topic of seabed mining off the coastline of California. I have seen the commission's draft strategic plan for 2021 to 2025 that was released for public comment, and we are encouraged that the commission has recognized the importance and potential threat that seabed mining poses to California's marine ecosystems by expressing an interest in commencing a collaborative stakeholder dialogue to explore this issue within the context of other extractive industries. And while considering the development and encouragement of renewable energy sources, the commission has signaled its proactive leadership on this topic. We support the commission's intentions to consult with other agencies to explore this issue and possible solutions, and recognize the need for diverse, inclusive stakeholder representation when formulating next steps of action. We also appreciate that the commission takes the public trust doctrine to heart, vowing to steward and protect the public's right to use California's waterways, including for natural habitat protection, and to reflect the values of an evolving society. This means keeping a check on the privatization of our coastal ecosystems that are critical for climate resilience, as well as planetary and human health, and that can be undermined by extractive industries. In closing, we want to reiterate our gratitude for the Commission's intentions to move forward with exploring policy options to address this issue, and affirm our position that seabed mining does not belong in California's coastal waters. The strategic plan cites the dire predictions outlined within California's fourth climate change assessment report of 2018. And within this context, I can't imagine the commission not taking action to proactively address and prevent activities that threaten coastal resilience or coastal restoration in the face of climate chaos. Now is the time to preempt, mitigate, and restore our natural heritage, not leave it vulnerable to exploitation. Thank you for taking steps in the right direction. We pledge our support as you continue your review of this important issue, and we'll provide more detailed comments before the January 31st deadline. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Courtney. Katie, our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Casey Cruikshank.
Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, commissioners and staff. My name is Casey Cruikshank from the North Coast Environmental Center. And thank you for allowing me time to speak with you today. We're very pleased to hear that the commission is looking into a holistic approach on how to potentially prohibit the practice of seabed mining from taking place off the coast of California. It's encouraging to receive feedback from the commission and a good explanation regarding where the commission stands on the issue and how you plan to move forward with developing foundational policies and regulations when considering potentially granting leases to mining companies. We will continue to engage on the issue, look forward to hearing more from you in the new year, and appreciate your hard work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Casey. Our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Andrew Thurber.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to provide public comment. My name is Andrew Thurber. I'm an assistant professor of oceanography at Oregon State University, and I'm an expert in marine ecosystem function and services. My views that I'm expressing today are my own and not meant to be representative of my employer. First off, I'd really like to commend you on your draft strategic plan, as it was a visionary statement, and it was inclusive of focusing on climate issues, including aspirational views of a realized post-petroleum era. I also applaud moving away from non-renewable extractive land uses, as this is an appropriate and lofty goal. As climate change impacts are specifically identified in the plan through listening and during previous commission meetings and also reading previous public testimony, seabed mining was a further identified threat to what California state lands can provide. Seabed mining is a non-renewable land use. Within your draft plan, I particularly appreciated the Commission's inclusion of a collaborative dialogue approach towards evaluating non-renewable uses. When discussing ocean uses, studies have found broad public support for a no-net loss of biodiversity, and in particular, protection for habitats that lead to healthy fisheries. Biodiversity in the ocean is driven by habitat diversity. Habitat diversity is created by many of the same compounds that are potential foci of mining from shallow to deep waters, including California state-managed lands. The hard substrate that is often the focus of mining operations can provide substrate for kelp forests, deep rocky reefs, and other habitats that add to the biodiversity of California's coast and also lead to economic diversity, including supporting healthy fish stocks. Mining removes this underlying habitat diversity and can impact ocean function and what society gets from it, including recreation, tourism, and recreational and commercial fishing success. Those things that have also been identified as significant value in scientific studies on what people value. The ocean, its habitats, and its ecosystems are also highly connected. I personally think of the ocean as everyone's backyard, but nobody has any fences. What happens in one habitat impacts adjacent habitats and also what we get from the ocean. Sediment plumes, loss of habitat, and the release of potentially harmful compounds have wide-ranging and unintended impacts on the marine environment. In addition, these impacts are hard to study. Fish ecologist friend of mine says counting fish is like counting trees, except they're invisible and they move. Quantifying impacts of marine mining is just as nefarious, and the impacts are unidirectional, potentially forever, and often with widespread and unexpected consequences due to the connected aspect of ocean ecosystem. This creates a real challenge for management, and in particular, land use management. For that, I applaud your including an approach of collaborative dialogue and movement towards critical and informed evaluation of non-renewable land use. I personally support, based on my area of expertise, identifying seabed mining as a type of future that is not in line with the just transition to renewables, and in particular due to its potential widespread and connected impact on California's vibrant coastal ecosystem and economies. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Katie, our next speaker, please.
Our next speaker is Tom Rudolph.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Chair Yee, members of the commission and staff. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Great. For the record, my name is Tom Rudolph, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Pew Charitable Trusts. I'm here today to commend your efforts to date in the development of this new strategic plan draft, to express our support and appreciation for the language in the draft that is intended to incorporate and address the concerns we have raised throughout 2020 about the inevitable emergence of interest in seabed mining on and under submerged lands that you hold in trust, and to offer some preliminary suggestions for improvements to that language. As we've stated previously, the thoughtful and accessible manner in which you all developed this draft and the fact that you've kept the effort on track and on time in this year of unprecedented challenges is truly impressive. We're pleased to see that the Commission is proposing a collaborative and comprehensive effort to look broadly at extractive uses of state lands and to evaluate the need for policy or regulatory change in the context of a transition to renewable uses under the evolving mandates of the public trust doctrine. This proposed commitment in the activities it envisions, found in Goal 4A under the evolving public trust doctrine focus area, look like a good way to begin reviewing the Commission's current regulatory regime for marine minerals and to consider our proposals for reform. The first time I had the opportunity to address you all on this topic earlier this year, I told you all how exciting I found your use of the word evolving in the context of the public trust doctrine, and I greatly appreciate how much you've drilled down on that concept in this new draft. I want to highlight some language from page 13 in the narrative section that explores evolving public trust principles and values as a driver of change that describes the protection of ecosystem integrity for current and future generations as a foundational responsibility. Our concerns and proposed solutions relative to marine mining are grounded in an ecosystem-based approach and are very much related to the potential for marine mining to cause disruptions in ecosystem structure, function, and services that are long-term or even irreversible in nature. This leads to our first preliminary suggestion for strengthening this draft. In our letter to the Commission for this meeting, we further explored prior suggestions we had submitted of focusing on ecosystem services in any treatment of seabed mining. And I think and hope that those suggestions are very applicable to the effort envisioned under Call to Action 4 and its underlying Goal 4A. I encourage you to consider factoring those concepts into any further development of the 4A convening in this plan and as work unfolds after a final plan is adopted. Also, in light of our specific concerns about seabed mining, we'd also like to request that 4A explicitly call out that potential extractive activity as an example of a commission-managed use that's in need of collaborative attention and careful evaluation, And we would also like to suggest the addition of a second bullet that clearly communicates a commitment to action in the form of promoting and adopting any policy changes for which a need is identified under the convening activities in 4A. We'll remain enthusiastically engaged in this process through the submission of more detailed written comments later, early next year, and in any collaborative dialogue that emerges from the ideas inherent in this draft. And we thank you all sincerely for your attention to our concerns and your continued efforts.
Thank you, Tom, very much for your comments. Katie, our next speaker.
Yes, our next speaker is Andrea Tracy.
Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, Chair Yee, members of the commission and commission staff. My name is Andrea Treese, and I'm speaking on behalf of Earth Justice. I first want to thank the commission and staff for the incredible amount of work that has gone into the draft plan and the really thoughtful way that you've integrated stakeholder input. I'll just offer some preliminary comments on the draft this morning, but look forward to offering more in-depth comments as the process continues. I also want to just note the breadth and importance of the topics the draft addresses, the forward-looking focus on climate change and environmental justice, incorporating tribal knowledge and really focusing on public health and sustainability. We particularly appreciate the draft plan's focus on the evolving public trust values and the opportunities inherent in that area to proactively consider and foreclose destructive non-renewable activities like seabed mining. As we noted in our prior written comments, the California Public Trust Doctrine has evolved, as the commission is recognizing, to recognize the critical value of conserving trust lands for uses like providing habitat for fish and wildlife, for scientific study, as well as supporting public health. And of course, all of those things support economic and social concerns, such as fisheries and recreation and coastal communities. We fully support the commission's intent to fulfill and further this evolving doctrine by placing a priority on sustainability and justice. And in that vein, we encourage the commission to keep and strengthen its goal four under the evolving public trust issues bullet to explicitly include seabed mining as one of the non-renewable practices the commission will examine, and further encourage the commission to add the goal of proposing and adopting proactive policies that prohibit non-renewable extractive practices on state lands and support a just transition to renewables. We believe that this goal is an important one and will really help the commission to address conservation, health, and sustainability of our coastal resources. We look forward to working with you on these issues. And thanks again so much for your effort and time. Hope everyone has safe and happy holidays. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea, for your comments. Our next speaker, Katie.
Our next speaker is with Channel Islands Restoration.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Yee and members of the Commission. I'm Ken Owen, Executive Director of Channel Islands Restoration. We're a nonprofit habitat restoration contractor based in Santa Barbara. We restore habitat on the Channel Islands and adjacent mainland, Ventura, LA, and Santa Barbara County. This draft strategic plan is really, from my perspective, a wonderful vision of sustainability and public health for state lands for the years to come. And I'm, like everyone, I'm really impressed with the work by the staff and the commission, especially during these hard times on this amazing document. I'd like to address again the issue of seabed mining, and I'd like to thank the staff for addressing the issue of potentially prohibiting the practice in the draft. I see the draft as a great step forward. Just my first thoughts, developing meaningful policies and regulations that potentially prohibit seabed mining. If I had any suggestions on the draft, it'd be kind of along the lines of what others have said. Perhaps I respectfully suggest that you more explicitly acknowledge the numerous comments that you've received on the issue of seabed mining. I agree, I'll just save you the time on the actions of that others have suggested in 4A. With that, I too would like to wish you a safe and hopefully happy holiday season. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken, very much. Our next speaker.
Next speaker is Jennifer Savage.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning, Chair Yi, Commissioners, Jennifer Savage, Surfrider Foundation. We wanted to add our kudos to your staff for developing this plan despite the unforeseen and extreme challenges of 2020. And while we're still taking a deep dive into the draft plan, at first glance, we're quite heartened about a number of elements, including the attention to educating people about the public trust and the intention to work with a broad range of stakeholders in addressing sea level rise, especially tribal representatives whose traditional ecological knowledge will be critical to successful adaptation in the future. As discussed at the start of the year, the transition off fossil fuels, though imperative, isn't easy, so full attention must be given to how to do so in the fastest, fairest manner. On that note, Surfrider echoes our colleagues' recommendations regarding a minor addition of language to Goal 4A, further defining non-renewable extractive practices as including but not limited to seabed mining. With that, we congratulate your staff, and we look forward to submitting far more detailed written comments next month. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Our next speaker.
Next speaker is Mona Tucker.
Good morning, Mona.
Mona, you might need to unmute yourself.
Mona, are you there? You can hear me. You are probably on mute.
I'm very sorry for the delay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Welcome.
Achumi Sasaksi. Hello, my friends. My name is Mona Olivas Tucker, and I'm the tribal chair for Yaktichu Tichu Yaktalhini, Northern Chumash Tribe of San Luis Obispo County and Region. And good morning to Chairperson Yi and to the rest of the commission. I want to thank you for the excellent outreach to the tribal communities by your exceptional staff regarding this strategic plan. I'm heartened to read it. We will be making some comment, and I'm also grateful that the timeline for comment has been extended. For a non-federally recognized tribe, we typically do not have staff or resources to call on, and so it does take us more time than maybe others. So we're appreciative of that and appreciative of this work overall. And we appreciate everyone's time this morning. My only suggestion to everybody here and all of your comments, which I can say I agree with almost all of them, is that to be thinking what you'd like to see 100 years from now, because what we're doing today will have impact, long-term, far-reaching impact. We actually look further out than that. Coming from people who've been here for well over 10,000 years, we really want to suggest to you, recommend to you that you think in very far-reaching terms, 100, 500, even 1,000 years. And that's the end of my comments, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Mona. We look forward to your further comments, and thank you for the encouragement to look beyond just the time frame of our strategic plan. Our next speaker, Katie.
Our next speaker is Patricia McPherson.
Okay.
Hello.
Good morning, Patricia. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to speak. Patricia McPherson again with Grassroots Coalition.
I'm very glad to see this draft, and we will be responding as well. And I appreciate the language from the other speakers, and I very much appreciate the tribal language that you have in here for respect. And I would like to bring to your attention for climate change and sea level rise. One of the issues that I've gone to numerous meetings on sea level rise and workshops, and I've found a critical gap of information and or lack of address altogether regarding acknowledging, understanding, and protecting coastal freshwater aquifers, such as exists at the Biona Gap in Los Angeles. We've been told at these meetings that specific studies for specific areas still need to be performed in order to address coastal freshwater aquifers and their protection. But what I don't find is this issue being addressed overall when it comes to sea level rise. And we would like to see that addressed as well. We would also like to remind State Lands Commission of sea level rise and saltwater corrosion issues that in particular here in the Los Angeles area, we have SoCal Gas underground gas storage operations and their wells are affected by saltwater corrosion. So what we would like to have the assistance from the State Lands Commission is to, well, number one, not to waste public dollars in the creation of further saltwater intrusion and inundation problems, but to also not create problems from that corrosion of that saltwater upon wells that are oil and gas wells that we are still trying to protect the public from the leakage that is given rise as a result of that corrosion. So just to bring that to your attention, and again, thank you very much that you are working on these issues, and I'm very pleased to see this draft, and we will be commenting on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Next speaker.
Chair Yee, at this time, we have no other hands raised for public comment.
Thank you very much, Katie. Commissioners, let me just look to you. Any other comments or questions at this point? Okay, seeing none, thank you to all of the speakers. Thank you for the presentation. We do look forward to additional submissions of public comment by February 1st of 2021. And you can do that by email via the email address strategicplan@slc.ca.gov, or you can phone in your comments at 916-574-1800. All of this information is on the State Lands Commission website. So thank you very much for the robust presentation and all of the public comment. Let's move on to the next item, which is item 61. And this is to consider approval of the legislative report, the 2021 biennial report of the California Marine Invasive Species Program. May we have the presentation?
Yes, our senior environmental scientist, Lena Ceballos Osana, will be presenting on behalf of the commission, and her presentation will be loading shortly.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Lena.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good afternoon. Good morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Lena Ceballos Osuna, and I am a senior environmental scientist with the Marine Invasive Species Program. I will be presenting the biennial report on the California Marine Invasive Species Program for your consideration and approval. Next slide. The purpose of this report is to provide an update to the legislator on the Marine Invasive Species Program activities during the period of January 2018 to December 2019. The report includes a summary of vessel reported data, an update on implementation of ballast water discharge performance standards, the most recent research related to invasive species, and the main accomplishments of the program during this time. Additionally, we present the next steps for the program and the recommendations to the commission and the legislator. Next slide. Non-indigenous species are organisms that are intentionally or unintentionally transported through human activities to new habitats. Once established, they can become invasive, posing significant threats to human health, the economy, and the environment. Next slide. Shipping is responsible for up to 79% of established aquatic non-indigenous species in North America. Commercial ships transport organisms through ballast water and vessel biofouling. Prevention of species introductions through vector management is the most effective way to protect California waters from non-indigenous species. Next slide. The Marine Invasive Species Program is a statewide multi-agency program designated to prevent the introduction of non-indigenous species from vessels arriving at California ports. Next slide. In this graph, we show the number of vessels arriving at California ports per year since 2010. During 2018 and 2019, California ports received about 11,000 arrivals per year. Over the past decade, the number of arrivals has been trending upwards. Next slide. The most common management approach used by vessels in California continues to be not discharging or retaining ballast water while at port. During the reporting period, approximately 85% of vessel arrivals did not discharge ballast water, presenting zero risk of ballast water-mediated introductions. For those vessels that discharged, ballast water exchange was the most common management method used. However, the use of alternative methods, specifically the use of ballast water treatment systems, is increasing rapidly. Next slide. The Marine Invasive Species Act mandates the Commission to inspect at least 25% of vessels arriving at California ports to assess compliance with ballast water and biofouling regulations. Commission staff faced challenges meeting the mandate during the two-year reporting period due to personnel shortages and access limitations at some ports. There have been ongoing challenges recruiting and filling vacancies in the inspector's classification because the job requirements are outdated. Next slide. The Marine Invasive Species Program had many accomplishments during the past 2 years. One of the most notable was the high compliance rate observed. More than 97% of all California arrivals were compliant with both ballast water and biofouling management regulations. Less than 1% of ballast water discharged in California was non-compliant. And 96% of the vessels that initially were found non-compliant with the biofouling regulations corrected the deficiency after the initial inspection. Next slide. In 2018, the latest ballast water treatment technology assessment report was submitted to the legislature. In response to the recommendations in this report, the legislature passed Assembly Bill 912, delaying implementation of the California interim and final ballast water discharge standards. This bill also authorized the commission to adopt and implement federal ballast water discharge standards. Commission staff began the formal rulemaking process for these regulations in November, and currently we are in the public comment period until January 19, 2021. Next slide. In late 2018, the Federal Vessel Incidental Discharge Act, also known as VIDA, was signed into law. Once fully implemented, VIDA will preempt the state authority to adopt or implement the state-specific vessel discharge management requirements or standards. States will retain authority to inspect vessels, enforce federal requirements, and continue to collect reporting form and fees with some restrictions. After VIDA implementation, the California Marine Invasive Species Control Fund is projected to lose between $300,000 and $500,000 in revenue each year due to the cap on vessel arrival fees. This loss will push the fund towards insolvency by fiscal year 2024. As a reminder, the Marine Invasive Species Program is entirely funded by vessel arrival fees. Next slide. Over the next 2 years, the Marine Invasive Species Program will work on high priority actions, including the adoption of the Federal Ballast Water Discharge Performance Standards and development of protocols to assess vessel compliance. We will amend the enforcement regulations to incorporate both ballast water and biofouling violations, implement a new pre-arrival risk assessment process to more effectively and efficiently allocate inspection resources, track vessel patterns to analyze the effect of the recession caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, and actively engage and participate in the process to implement VITA. Next slide. The staff requests your approval of the report, including the following recommendations to the legislator. Support the Commission's effort to remove recruitment barriers for the inspector's job specification to enable a larger, more diverse, and maximally inclusive pool of candidates to better reflect the people of California. Work collaboratively with all the stakeholders and the regulated community to secure ongoing funding for the Marine Invasive Species Control Fund to mitigate the impact of VITA and the impact of the reduction in shipping traffic due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and to support the amendment of the Revenue and Taxation Code to ensure efficient and effective fee collection. Finally, to support the reintroduction of passage of Assembly Joint Resolution 25 to signal California's opposition to preemption of a state authority under VITA. Next slide. With that, I would like to thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lena, for the presentation. Commissioners, any questions or comments? Yes, Commissioner Miller.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, the work on this is incredible and just huge kudos to the staff. We are going to abstain just because of the interaction with the legislature, but certainly want to send our great thanks to all the work that's been done and the remarkable work and presentation by Ms. Ceballos. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Miller.
I will move yes. The item. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And also want to add my recognition of the hard work of staff on this.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Kunalakis. A motion by Commissioner Kunalakis to approve the legislative report. I will second that motion. And I just have one question that it have to do with the federal standards versus the California standards. And could you just remind us again about, I guess, the differences? Because I think one of the things I'm mindful of just kind of going forward is with any of our state agencies is whether we've had to adopt federal standards that may have been less robust than state standards, and whether that should be an area of focus going forward.
Lena, go ahead, unless you would like to have Nicole answer, but please.
I can answer that, I think. Yeah, California interim and final ballast water performance standards are more stringent, and currently there is not an available technology to meet those standards. So based on the technology assessment report, the recommendations on that report, and the Assembly Bill 912,
yes.
It was decided that if we adopt federal standards, at least we can assess compliance and enforce.
Okay. All right.
Nicole, I don't know if you want to complement that answer.
Okay. Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. All right, so we have a motion and a second, but before we move to the vote, Katie, let me check in and see if there are any public comments on this item.
Thank you, Chair Yee. At this time, we have no hands raised for public comment.
Great, thank you. All right, Ms. Lucchesi, would you take the roll?
Certainly. Commissioner Kunalakis.
Aye.
I'm abstaining. I'm sorry, I can barely hear you, Ms. Lucchesi. Thank you.
Chair Yee?
Aye.
The motion passes 2-0 with Commissioner Miller abstaining.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. Okay, moving on to our next item. Item 62 is a progress report on the Commission's second year implementation of the new environmental justice policy. Maybe we have the presentation. Actually, before we move on, I'm mindful of just the staff monitoring the virtual meeting. Does anybody need a break?
I am looking at Kim, our meeting liaison, and our court reporter. It looks like we can continue.
Okay, Thank you. Sure. We are on the environmental justice policy. May we have the presentation?
So while this presentation is loading, I would like to introduce the commission and the public to our new environmental justice liaison, Jessica Ramirez. I did introduce her at the October meeting, but this is her first presentation to the commission and to the public. And I'm just so grateful she has joined our team. She is amazing. That you will find her to be extremely great at her job. So we're very lucky for her on our team.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, Jessica, and welcome.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer, for those kind words. And thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Jessica Ramirez, as stated, and I am the new Environmental Justice Liaison at the Commission. I started my role at the beginning of October, and since then have immersed myself in learning the ins and outs of the Commission and our environmental justice policy. Hiring an environmental justice liaison was one of the Commission's goals this year, and I am honored to have been selected to serve the Commission and the people of California. Over this past year, our staff and internal environmental justice team have diligently and carefully worked to implement the Commission's environmental justice policy. Today, I will provide an update on our progress during the second year of implementation. Next slide, please. Much like our first year, staff has worked internally and externally on policy implementation, collaborating with environmental justice organizations, tribal government representatives, and other agencies to implement the policy. Today, I will provide a brief overview of our policy, discuss interagency partnerships and staff trainings. I will also discuss the development of processes for environmental justice outreach and launching a justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion team. I will conclude with an outlook for the year ahead. Next slide, please. When the Commission adopted a comprehensive environmental justice policy and implementation framework in 2018, it committed to the principle that past environmental injustices will not define California's future. And that commitment is just as important today, if not more so, than it was in 2018. The policy outlines 12 goals, reflecting input from community outreach and guidance from an environmental justice working group. They are also reflective of climate change and how the impacts on human health disproportionately affect marginalized and disadvantaged communities. As the Commission works to adapt to climate change and promote climate resiliency, addressing environmental justice will be imperative. This year presented new challenges because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which shifted how we approach our work. The pandemic created additional barriers to participating in government processes, further constraining the limited capacity and resources many environmental justice organizations and tribal communities already experience. Staff is working diligently to ensure equitable public participation during this challenging time. Next slide, please. I would like to highlight three key activities staff was involved in this year. They are a community outreach and engagement workshop, developing a train-the-trainer guide on how to effectively conduct community outreach and engagement, and participation in an interagency coordination group. Next slide, please. Meaningful community outreach and engagement are foundational to environmental justice. When Governor Newsom signed AB 1628 Rivas into law in September 2019,
he amplified changing California's definition of environmental justice to include the meaningful involvement of people of all races, cultures, incomes, and national origins. This change aligns with the focus of the Commission's partnership earlier this year with the California Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Conservation, State Water Resources Control Board, California Public Utilities Commission, California Department of Public Health, and the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability to develop an in-depth workshop outreach and engagement from a state agency and community organization perspective. This team developed a model curriculum and held an all-day workshop in February of this year. The training, attended by about 130 staff from multiple agencies, included modules, panels, interactive activities, and firsthand accounts on ways to effectively engage communities. Many agency staff have expressed a lack of training and understanding about how to engage communities in their agency's processes. This curriculum helped fill a critical gap and provided staff with education and tools to engage more meaningfully with community members. And the partnerships and relationships that were created from this training have enriched our staff, improve how we implement our policy, and helped us achieve environmental justice in our work. Next slide, please. This same interagency team is developing a train-the-trainer guide and curriculum based on the materials and presentations from the workshop. This material will be hosted alongside other online engagement resources on the California Natural Resources Agency's website. Next slide, please. Another way that staff is implementing the environmental justice policy is through interagency coordination. Staff is part of an environmental justice partnership that includes the Coastal Commission, Coastal Conservancy, Ocean Protection Council, BCDC, and NOAA. Staff participates in monthly coordination calls with these agencies to discuss equity and environmental justice in our work. Next slide, please. Staff developed a worksheet that our land management and mineral resources management divisions are used to determine when environmental justice outreach is necessary. This past year, staff sent nearly 600 letters related to 21 lease applications or proposed projects. Among the key actions that involved environmental justice outreach this year are two geothermal leases issued at the October meeting. Consistent with its environmental justice policy, staff evaluated the location of the proposed lease areas to determine whether environmental burdens, should there be any, would disproportionately impact nearby communities. Staff outreached to environmental justice communities and sought input on the proposed leases. Staff contacted 45 individuals and representatives of environmental justice organizations and 28 tribal representatives to notify them and solicit comments. Next slide, please. So moving on, I am excited to announce that staff recently launched a Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion team. This new team, known as our JEDI team, is a participatory decision-making team dedicated to promoting equity, inclusion, and diversity and addressing environmental justice within the commission and through its work. The JEDI team complements the goals in our environmental justice policy and is intended to build on the efforts of the commission's Environmental Justice and Government Alliance on Race and Equity teams. Next slide, please. As you know, the Commission is developing a new strategic plan. This new plan, together with our environmental justice policy implementation blueprint, will provide the framework that guides our work in the years to come. In summary, although 2020 has been an incredibly difficult year, we have continued to make progress with implementing the Commission's environmental justice policy, and our commitment to environmental justice is stronger than ever.
Staff intends to continue to sustain and deepen interagency partnerships and relationships with environmental justice communities and advocates. Staff also intends to leverage the new strategic plan, once adopted, to guide how it prioritizes implementation of its environmental justice policy. Another area where staff expects to see growth in the coming year is in the intersection between climate change and environmental justice. I am sure there will be many other ways we will be implementing the policy in 2021 as we continue to grow, learn, and adapt. Next slide, please. The Commission and its staff have enthusiastically embraced the challenge to implement an environmental justice policy that is meaningful to the communities it serves and to the people of California. We are incredibly thankful for the work our internal environmental justice team and Commission staff have invested to implement the policy, and we are excited to continue to build on these efforts. We are especially grateful to the considerable support from the Commission's executive leadership and from the commissioners. We are also especially grateful to the community advocates that have taken time to engage with us and share their perspectives and suggestions. And finally, we are grateful to our sister agencies who we partner with. We have learned so much from each other. Thank you, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Questions or comments from commissioners?
Well, just another terrific presentation, and it's definitely the day for it. But, the emergence of equity and environmental policy has really exploded in recognition and understanding that we need to engage in this area. It's been neglected for too long. So thank you, Jennifer and Jessica and staff, for keeping this in focus and ramping up our engagement.
Thank you, Commissioner Kanellakis. Let me also thank the sustained focus on this. You know, we really pride ourselves on doing our work in partnership, and certainly the interagency coordination on so many issues, and having equity be and justice be at the core of that work is so important across all of our sister agencies. And it's really, I have to say, it's a very, very noticeable positive change. And this is change that's not easy, doesn't come easily, but at the same time, to see the commitment already, just with so many of our key policy issues really dedicated to kind of the Jedi lens, is really just very, very promising. So thank you, and look forward to the continued work.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let me turn to Katie to see if there are any public comments on this item. If anyone wishes to comment, please raise your Zoom hand now on item 62.
Thank you, Chair Yi. At this time, we have no hands raised for public comment.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much, Jessica. We look forward to upcoming reports and progress on this. Okay, commissioners, we are now on item 63. This is also an informational update on aquaculture in state and federal waters, including the establishment of aquaculture opportunity areas in federal waters. And we are going to have a presentation by, I believe, one of our Street Grant Fellows. Yes.
That's right. Mark Danielson will be giving staff. And while his PowerPoint is loading, I just want to highlight for the commission that the commission employs Sea Grant Fellows regularly each year. This year, we have been lucky enough to host two Sea Grant Fellows, Mark Danielson and Christina Kunkel, who you'll be hearing from later. And as I know you all know, all the commissioners know, the Sea Grant program, and particularly the Sea Grant Fellows that we've been lucky enough to host, have just been incredible and have really raised our game in terms of how we serve the public across all of our programs. And so it's really with great honor and privilege to introduce Mark to present to you on this important issue that the commission is facing along with our other partner agencies.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Mark, and welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Yi and commissioners.
My name is Mark Danielson, and I am a California Sea Grant Fellow at the Commission. And during the last 10 months, I have worked with Commission staff on a variety of issues relating to marine spatial planning. And an ever-present theme throughout has been the importance of California's coastal communities and the opportunities that a diverse blue economy can bring. Aquaculture has existed in California for many years, but renewed interest in expanding the aquaculture industry could give it a more prominent role in California's blue economy. Today, I will give an informational update on the status of recent state and federal policies and strategies relevant to the development of a more robust and sustainable aquaculture industry in California. Next slide, please. First, I will go over the types of existing aquaculture in state waters, the importance of the industry, and how it relates to State Lands Commission's responsibility. Second, I will provide an update on the development of a set of statewide aquaculture principles by the Ocean Protection Council, an aquaculture permitting guidance document from the California Coastal Commission, and the process to select aquaculture opportunity areas in Southern California by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Finally, I will talk about the next steps that Commission staff intend to take regarding these initiatives. Next slide, please. The aquaculture industry is a significant part of the United States' blue economy. In 2017, the total value of marine and freshwater operations was $1.5 billion. Right now, California's contribution to that number is small, just over 1% of that total. A recent report from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimated that the U.S. imports 90% of the food that we eat, and half of that comes from foreign aquaculture farms. The demand for seafood is rising in the U.S., and the aquaculture industry in California could grow to meet it. Next slide, please. Currently, there are 17 active marine aquaculture farms in state waters, the locations of which are highlighted on this map. Many of these farms are located on submerged and tidal sovereign land granted to local jurisdictions by the legislature. Only seaweed and shellfish are permitted for cultivation and harvesting in state waters. Some farms use the space under and around piers and marinas to grow their products, making efficient use of existing facilities and decreasing the need for more ocean space. There is even emerging interest in repurposing decommissioned oil platforms for seaweed and shellfish cultivation. The role of the State Lands Commission in the California aquaculture industry remains vital. Next slide, please. The Fish and Game Commission is responsible for authorizing water bottom leases for aquaculture. State Lands Commission staff often provide advisory support to colleagues at Fish and Game due to our expertise in leasing and managing public trust land and resources. In addition, the commission leases some ancillary structures associated with aquaculture farms, such as docks and seawater intakes. Commission staff also contribute to interagency working groups and efforts to develop aquaculture policies and projects because of our experience balancing benefits and impacts of public trust uses and resources. Next slide, please. Aquaculture is highlighted in the Ocean Protection Council's 2020 to 2025 strategic plan. And in September of this year, the OPC authorized the development of a statewide aquaculture action plan. The purpose of the action plan is to promote a sustainable commercial aquaculture industry in California. It will outline a coordinated approach for considering, approving, and managing proposed projects. While the action plan is under development, the OPC is creating statewide aquaculture principles that will serve as interim guidance to state agencies, as well as industry partners when considering and approving proposed aquaculture projects. Commission staff and folks from other related agencies have engaged with OPC on this effort by providing review and feedback. They are set to be finalized soon. The Marine Resources Committee of the Fish and Game Commission voted to continue the hiatus on processing new lease applications until the statewide aquaculture principles are finalized, highlighting the importance of these principles to the future development of the industry. Next slide, please. The California Coastal Commission has also been active in the realm of aquaculture this year. In 2019, Senate Bill 262 directed the Coastal Commission to develop guidance for applicants seeking coastal development permits for aquaculture. The guidance is meant to increase efficiency and reduce duplication, time, and costs associated with the permitting process. Staff from the Coastal Commission have been in collaboration with State Lands Commission staff, as well as other agencies and stakeholders, throughout this process. And the final guidance document was just recently released this month. Next slide, please. There is active interest in aquaculture in federal waters off California as well. An executive order issued in May of this year prompted NOAA to identify aquaculture opportunity areas, or AOAs, in specific regions of the U.S. Two regions have thus far been identified, the Gulf of Mexico and Southern California. The process will result in the identification of one AOA in the Southern California region, as well as other alternative areas. The actual AOAs are designed to be small areas within these regions that are suitable for sustainable offshore aquaculture. According to NOAA, these AOAs will be identified based on the best available science and current data on ocean uses. They are evaluating extensive data sets on fishing zones, vessel traffic patterns, whale and bird migration routes, existing oil and gas lease locations, and military uses. The AOAs will offer opportunity not just for shellfish and seaweed aquaculture, but also for offshore finfish operations. This process is 3 years, with the spatial analysis and AOAs being identified in the first, and a programmatic environmental impact statement for aquaculture development within the AOA throughout the following 2 years. NOAA staff has stated that they are committed to extensive stakeholder engagement and a robust public input process, and commission staff are tracking this process closely due to the potential for both impacts and benefits to public trust resources that could result from the effort. Next slide, please. The next steps for commission staff will be to continue to engage with OPC staff to finalize the statewide aquaculture principles. Commission staff will also participate in the federal AOA identification process, including the development of the programmatic environmental impact statement. Lessons learned from previous marine spatial planning efforts by the commission, such as the San Diego Ocean Planning Partnership, can be shared with NOAA, particularly regarding the establishment of a robust stakeholder outreach and public input process. By providing our expertise to other federal and state agency partners, commission staff can ensure public trust, land, and resources are fully considered and protected in the growth of a sustainable aquaculture industry. We can help drive the expansion of this important sector of the blue economy through enhanced collaboration, coordination, and alignment of state policies and goals. Next slide, please. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you for the presentation, Mark. Questions or comments by commissioners?
Thank you again for this great presentation.
Yeah, it's an exciting presentation. I just had one question, Mark, and that is, I think that the statewide principles on aquaculture, is that limited just to seaweed and shellfish for now? I think is offshore finfish not going to be incorporated in the principles initially while we're looking at what happens in these opportunity areas?
That's correct. To my understanding, It does not include offshore finfish aquaculture, but in addition to shellfish and seaweed, it will also include information on the finfish aquaculture that we do permit.
Yes.
On land. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you. All right. Let's see if we have any public comments on this item. Katie, we're now at item 63. If you do have any public comment to offer to the commission, please raise your Zoom hand now.
Thank you, Chair Yee. At this time, we have no hands raised for public comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you again very much for the presentation, Mark, and look forward to continued progress in this area. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're now on item 64, which is also an informational update on AB 691 related to the legislatively granted public trust lands and sea level rise planning. And we have a presentation by our other Sea Grant fellow joining us today. Jennifer, you want to introduce?
Yes, it's also my pleasure to introduce Christina Kunkel, our other Sea Grant fellow, who's been working diligently on our AB 691 implementation, along with a ton of other stuff she's been helping us with. We have really been able to make significant progress on assessing the reports that have been submitted because of the work that she's contributed to this effort. So it's my pleasure to introduce Christina.
Great. Good afternoon, Christina, and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Yee, Commissioner. My name is Christina Kunkel, and I am a Sea Grant Fellow with the Commission. Today, I will provide a brief update on AB 691, specifically the two-page summary reports that staff developed this year in collaboration with consultant Rebel Coastal. Next slide, please. AB 691 was passed in 2013. It requires local jurisdictions that were granted state land by the legislature and who generate over $250,000 in public trust revenues annually to prepare a sea level rise vulnerability assessment for the commission. The assessments had to include an inventory of vulnerable public trust land and assets, maps of sea level rise for 2030, 2050, and 2100, financial costs of sea level rise, and a description of proposed adaptation strategies. The assessments will inform the commission on how to support grantees adapting to sea level rise and protecting state land and public trust resources. Earlier this year, we gave the commission a presentation about our work to review the full assessments and identify challenges that the grantees encountered. Since then, we have been working on a draft summary report that we will present early next year. We have also organized the information from the full length assessments into concise two-page summaries. Next slide, please. The two-page summaries are companion pieces to the full assessments. After the initial assessment and reviews, it was clear the submissions reflected a range of approaches and also a wide variety in length, from less than 10 pages to more than 600 pages. Our intention was to create a standard, easily digestible format to communicate the most critical and noteworthy findings to the public and decision makers, and also make it easier to compare and contrast vulnerabilities and develop analysis. Next slide, please. I'm going to highlight a couple of the two-page summaries we have created, the first being Port of San Diego, and the second is the City of Crescent City. We selected these two to feature because the assessments they submitted were exemplary. These two are models, and we want to highlight and elevate their stories. Each two-page summary includes a site description, a list of vulnerable public trust resources, anticipated costs of sea level rise, and proposed adaptation and mitigation strategies. This is your window into the full assessments to learn about each community, the risks they face, and how they are preparing to protect and adapt state land and resources for sea level rise. Next slide, please. This is a snapshot of one section of the Port of San Diego's two-page summary, the anticipated costs of sea level rise adaptation. Note that by 2100, the port expects repair and replacement costs of facilities to potentially exceed $1 billion if no action is taken to minimize risk. As a major port, we expected high dollar amounts here, but this is very high. And it's not just damages to structures. The port and other grantees also estimated losses from impacts to beach tourism and recreation and loss of habitats like salt marshes and eelgrass beds. Due to a lack of detailed economic data for some of these risks, it is possible the financial costs from sea level rise will be even greater than what has been estimated in the assessments. Next slide, please. From our southernmost grantee to our northernmost grantee, here is Crescent City's two-page summary. You can see that the format is consistent with the Port of San Diego's. Next slide, please. Let's take a closer look at the adaptation and mitigation measures proposed by the City of Crescent City. They plan to implement a combination of accommodation, protection, and retreat strategies. To accommodate higher water levels, they plan to elevate a critical section of Redwood Highway, as well as pedestrian paths and public access points. They plan to fortify a breakwater and implement a beach nourishment program. And they will identify the highest hazard areas to limit development there and plan for a retreat of the most vulnerable facilities and assets. Many grantees considered a similar set of options to adapt to sea level rise and make their coastal areas more resilient to these risks. Next slide, please. Every grantee has its own unique attributes that will influence how it will grapple with sea level rise. Each two-page summary highlights a noteworthy element of the grantee's full-length assessment. For Crescent City, we featured information they provided on social equity, environmental justice, and the needs of vulnerable communities. Crescent City is in Del Norte County, one of the poorest and most rural counties in the state that is often overlooked. and less likely to have the capacity and resources to respond to sea level rise and flooding. The city plans to engage frequently with the fishing and recreation communities and will experience some of the greatest impacts so that strategies for adaptation meet their needs. Next slide, please. Environmental justice was not required to be addressed as part of the AB 691 assessment process, but EJ and equity concerns quickly emerged through our review. As we look at these assessments individually, it's difficult to see the magnitude of inequity that sea level rise impacts have on communities. But when we put all of the pieces together, it is evident that there is disproportionate damage done to low-income communities and communities of color as a result of sea level rise. We need to prioritize solutions that support equitable adaptation. Planning for the future of rising seas is important, but we should recognize that sea level rise is happening now, today. The dramatic photos of flooding that I've included in this presentation have all been captured during events in just the last few years. Next slide, please. To further show you how vulnerable some communities already are to sea level rise, I just want to tell you a little bit about research I did before my fellowship within the jurisdiction of one of our AB 691 grantees, Humboldt Harbor District. Mm-hmm. As part of my thesis research at Humboldt State University, I interviewed residents of King Salmon, a community that floods regularly with king and high tides. It is likely the most vulnerable area to sea level rise on the entire US West Coast. The average income of most residents is very low. They do not have the resources to protect their neighborhoods nor leave them. The image on the right is of me standing on the street in King Salmon last year, measuring floodwaters during a king tide. The image on the left shows how much flooding may occur by the end of the century on a monthly basis. All of the parcels and the only access road to enter King Salmon are completely inundated. Nearby, Highway 101 is underwater at least monthly, as is the PG&E power plant that provides energy to the state's grid and stores spent nuclear fuel. We could lose entire communities in just a few decades without major interventions. These individual locations do not only represent the community that will be lost, but valuable shorelines that matter to all people in California. The AB 691 project can help the state figure out how to prioritize support so that we can avoid the most catastrophic consequences of sea level rise. Next slide, please. We plan to post the two-page summaries on our website by the end of next month. We are also developing a comprehensive summary report and will present this to the commission as early as the February 2021 meeting. The link to our AB 691 website is right here, and most of the full-length assessments are already available at that link. Next slide, please. I want to thank the commission for the opportunity to participate in the Sea Grant Fellowship this year. The work that you're doing and that I've been able to participate in has truly been inspirational and life-changing. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Christina. Questions or comments, commissioners?
None, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Miller.
Just again, a great presentation to both our Sea Grant fellows, and so great to see folks committed to these issues and working so hard on them. Really appreciate your perspective on sea level rise and the potential impacts and everything that the commission is doing to really work collaboratively, not only on this, but on all the issues with our sister agencies and across departments. I think will be really important that we continue that coordination as we go forward, because I think without that type of coordination, we'll continue to see kind of siloed approaches to this. So just to you, Christina, how do you see that coordination working? And is there any way in which you think that coordination could potentially improve in terms of communication or planning or a way to sort of execute cross-government levels?
Oh, well, that's a big question. And that's a great question. I mean, I think that the first thing I want to say, this isn't really going to answer your question, but I want to talk about how important it is to involve the community in these decisions. Because research shows that top-down climate policy, where government is just making decisions, can create conflict and resistance from communities when actually implemented. So listening to and engaging stakeholders affected by adaptation policy creates a pathway for identifying critical social impacts prior to policy implementation. We know that the people who live in these communities know their community better than anyone else. So it's critical they're at the center of those planning conversations. And that means planning public meetings, engaging the community, building adaptive capacity. The commission already does a fantastic job at this through implementation of your tribal and environmental justice policies. And then when it comes to planning interagency wide, I just think that there needs to be more of it. There needs to be more communication and more interagency work groups. We need to be communicating with each other. And not that we're not doing that already, but I think that we can always improve.
And if I could, through the chair, add on to that, please. I thought a really excellent explanation, and just to really elevate Christina's comment about focusing on community and regional approaches. I think that is a pathway to help align various state agencies in terms of mobilizing around a particular region or a community to help them address sea level rise and adaptation and other kind of resiliency efforts. We tend as agencies get into our silos. And when we change our focus to the communities in the region, we can rally around unique needs and issues, and it helps us get out of our silos. So I just wanted to elevate the thoughts that Christina had, because I thought they were spot on.
Thank you, Jennifer. And Christina, thank you for putting a good deal of attention on the issues of equity in your presentation as well. I think And certainly your last comment about really looking to our communities and our stakeholders in terms of really helping us identify what some of the pathways are is going to be very, very important. But again, I just want to say congratulations on the progress, because it just seems like we've moved so quickly from receiving these assessments that were just kind of all over the map, different formats from all kinds of parties, and then to actually have it now be in a form that we can actually communicate more easily to the public. The two-page concise summaries, I think, are fantastic. And that's not to say more refinement isn't necessary, but to really get to this point from where we started, I think, is just really a tremendous progress. So thank you for being a part of that. Let me look to Katie to see if there are any public comments on this item. We are on item 64. If you do wish to provide a comment to the commission, please raise your Zoom hand now.
Thank you, Chair Yee. We do have Robert Vandehook, who has raised his hand.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Robert.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Yee. This was a really great presentation, and appreciated very much, and credit to you as the commissioners and staff for doing this, and the California public being interested. And I think right off the bat, Christina's very, in the question she was asked, having the community involved is because they have expertise, and that's me as an example, with a marine biology, wildlife, oceanography background, studying California for 45 years along the seashore, from the Oregon border and down into Mexico. There's a lot of observations I've been making recently. Some of these are going to be hard to swallow in a sense, but since your mission or your kind of way you are looking at your commission, State Lands Commission, to include sustainability, economic viability, but reasonably, like, remember the exact phrase, indigenous peoples and EJ, and cost benefit analysis, and all the research that's been being done in the last 10 years on our rivers and how they enter into the sea, we now know that every single lagoon and estuary on the California coast, but one, San Francisco Bay, and possibly a second one in San Diego, all the other ones from Eureka and the Humboldt Bay to Oceanside, to others, are we're always closed to the sea every year, sometimes for multiple years without opening, by sandbars. The natural process of rivers bringing sand down to the ocean caused the blockage to the sea, good blockage, I might add. And for example, we now dredge Humboldt Bay, millions of dollars on an annual basis there alone. But then if you look up and down the coast, federal dollars of millions of dollars are being used, not in San Francisco Bay or San Diego Bay, because those are natural openings where the U.S. Navy and, but over and over again, we are dredging open with federal dollars and counties asking for it to be dredged for yacht harbors and that. And I think we're going to, and that's one of the ways that sea level rise comes pouring in to flood places on the coast, like the examples of salmon in Humboldt County and et cetera. And so adaptive management gets mentioned in Christina's presentation, but adaptive management means thinking about what we've done with our harbors, unnatural man-made harbors, and the habitat that would be gained if we terminated those harbors and did management in a new way. I know that means recreational sailing might be at issue, but this is the future, climate change. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for your comments. Our next speaker, Katie.
Our next speaker is Lily Sukuyama.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Yi, Commissioners, Executive Officer Lucchesi, and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to provide public comment on this item today. My name is Lily Tsukuyama, Associate Planner with the Port of San Diego. As a grantee of state lands, the Port is appreciative of the statewide coordination that the Commission has led on coastal resiliency efforts and sea level rise adaptation planning. Going through the AB 691 process as a grantee, we learned a lot about the vulnerability of San Diego Bay submerged lands and tidelands to sea level rise, and we are humbled that this item today highlights our report. I wanted to use my comments to briefly convey to the Commission how we've been using our AB 691 report since we submitted it last year. Some examples include consistently using our selected projections to identify appropriate adaptation measures in project approvals, such as elevating existing revetment for a new recreation open space area along the shoreline in Harbor Park in Chula Vista, which was recently approved by our board, advancing nature-based solutions along our bay shoreline. For example, e-concrete will soon be deployed in Harbor Island in North San Diego Bay to replace existing shoreline armoring with modular tide pools that will help to enhance biodiversity along with providing coastal resiliency benefits. We are also in the process of permitting a native oyster reef as a living shoreline in South San Diego Bay, and we appreciate the Commission's support as well as the State Coastal Conservancy's partnership on this effort. We are currently building an internal GIS application that includes our selected AB 691 sea level rise projections and results of the vulnerability assessment so that port staff can leverage the data when planning projects. We've been working with Scripps Institution of Oceanography and their Center for Climate Change Impacts and Adaptation to monitor wave activity in San Diego Bay and refine further sea level rise models for future assessments. And more broadly, we continue to partner with stakeholders in San Diego Bay, such as the U.S. Navy and jurisdictions along the San Diego coast, to share knowledge and best practices regarding sea level rise. Our MOU with the Navy is the first of its kind on the West Coast for information and data sharing on coastal resiliency. Coordination between the Port and Navy is essential to protect some of the most vulnerable, disadvantaged neighboring communities, which lie directly behind portside working waterfront assets and Navy infrastructure. This is the type of collaboration that will be needed for all of us in the San Diego region to address this complex issue together. We greatly appreciate our partnership with the State Lands Commission on adaptation planning and assuring coastal resiliency for state-granted public lands, and we look forward to reviewing the Commission's AB 691 Summary Assessment Report next year. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lily. And I'll just echo that we appreciate the partnership with the Port of San Diego as well. Our next speaker.
Our next speaker is Leslie Purcell.
Okay. Good afternoon, Leslie.
Good afternoon. I would like to just make a few comments. I found the last part of Christina's presentation was a little shocking in that one of the areas that would be submerged would include the PG&E plant and waste from radioactive waste. So this is really something that needs to be addressed. And, you know, we've got a couple other nuclear power plants up and down the coast that are in various stages of being decommissioned. But this is an issue that really needs to be taken seriously. Along those lines, I actually was at the California Coastal Commission, had a workshop this morning on sea level rise as well. And one thing that came up was the possible building of more desalination plants along the coastline. And this is another real concern because of sea level rise and, you know, the amount of energy that takes to run these things is not sustainable. And the piping, which would be through the tide lands, presumably, of intake and then outflow. There are a lot of issues that are very, very important and need to be considered. And you know, we need to find more sustainable ways to reuse our water and not create more large infrastructure along the coast that would affect our public trust lands. In Ventura, we have had a pretty successful first phase of the managed retreat shoreline near the Ventura River mouth. And that was a collaboration between a number of entities, city, county. Surf Rider Foundation was very helpful with that. So I just think there are, you know, ways that we can address these things that are more beneficial to the public. But again, it's very, very important. And I applaud the work that's being done on this because it's one of the big issues that we're going to have. I'd also like to mention protecting our freshwater wetlands and aquifers and from sea level rise and the intrusion of salt water. This is another consideration that I've had involvement at the Biona Wetlands area in LA. And I know there's another plan for so-called restoration that would allow a lot more seawater to come in. And the public, by and large, a lot of the community is not in favor of that. So, because we've already got seawater intrusion and pumping by the development and, you know, underground parking and other issues that really shouldn't be allowed in this area that's prone to sea level rise. One more thing. There is an issue, again, with the gas company at Playa del Rey storing large amounts of natural gas underground there. And again, this is something, there's been leakage. There are a lot of issues with that need to be addressed and hopefully phase out that natural gas storage in this populated area that's actually underlying wetlands as well and adjacent to the tidelands. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Our next speaker.
Thank you, Chair Yi. At this time, we have no other hands raised for public comment on this item.
Great. Thank you very much, Katie. Again, thank you very much, Christina, for the presentation and look forward to further updates on this front. Okay, Ms. Lucchese, what's our next order of business?
Our next order of business is our second public comment period.
Okay, great. So at this time, if anybody wishes to address the commission on any matter that is not on today's agenda, please raise your hand and you will have 3 minutes to do so. And Katie, when you're ready, if you'll call on the first person who'd like to make a public comment.
Thank you, Chair Yi. We have Lori Smith, who has raised her hand to provide public comment.
All right. Good afternoon, Lori.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Are you there?
Yes, we are here.
Great. Thank you so much. I am just calling in for about 2 minutes ago. So I am not sure if you have reached item agenda 58?
Yes, we have. We are past that item.
Is it possible that I speak to that?
Sure. Why don't we go ahead and take your comments on that?
Well, my name is Lori Smith. I'm the Vice President for Los Cerritos Wetlands Land Trust. You might be familiar with our work. We've been a long-term advocate for the wetlands here in Long Beach.
Yes.
I'm calling in to ask that you delay your decision for funding only of item number two portion of the agenda item for $300,000 until a later meeting. Our group was completely surprised to find out just now that the city was requesting $300,000 for a concept design for construction. Our consultants have been in contact with the city to request more information to determine if that previous study was conclusive and what other alternatives were studied. In my very brief reading of this, it looks like they've only studied one alternative. We are merely asking for a delay of item two, $300,000, so that the public can be informed and that the mission of the state lands be upheld. As per the 1964 statute granting the city these lands, they must be authorized from you to spend the tideland oil revenue on things that for uses and purposes that must be consistent with this granting statute, and it be for statewide purposes as opposed to purely local benefits. I'm asking just for a delay on item two of agenda item 58 in order that the public be assured that the 1964 statute is upheld. We had asked and were not informed about this, and we're merely asking to be to have some more time to look at it. Our city council member actually has a neighborhood meeting scheduled in a few weeks, so it's very surprising to see that they've moved on to the design concept when we're still looking at if their study was conclusive and if other alternatives have been looked at. This is something that I'm familiar with from the state, from the city doing other projects that they kind of put the, you know, went ahead of things, and I've had to sue the state and the city in order to do something correctly, and I've won that. And I'm wondering if this is another situation and we're just asking for more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Ms. Lucchese, do you want to comment on that particular item?
Yes, of course. And thank you, Ms. Smith, for providing that public comment. Unfortunately, the commission has acted on that item through their approval of the consent agenda. But what I would like to offer is myself and my team to connect with you at your convenience to talk through the State Lands Commission role in reviewing these expenditures, this particular expenditure that you have concerns about, and obviously how best we can engage with you moving forward so that you aren't caught by surprise with these kinds of agenda items in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Lucchese. Katie, next speaker.
Thank you, Chair Yee. At this time, we have no other hands raised for comment.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just turn to our commissioners and see if there are any questions or comments at this time. Okay, very well, thank you. Ms. Lucchese, I know we're gonna be recessing into closed session, but if I may, I just wanted to first thank my fellow commissioners for the work of this extraordinary year. It's you know, just taking stock of just what's been happening around us, and to see that this commission, the staff, everyone so committed to the mission of this commission has continued the work for the people of California. We're just so appreciative. And the ability to meet virtually, as someone said earlier, to be able to have broader reach to the public and to seek input on much of our business is really, really appreciated. I want to just also take note that it's an honor to serve with an all-women commission, and the alignment, I think, of all of us with respect to our duties as commissioners has been really extraordinary. And I know a proud moment for me of this past year, as I'm sure will be shared by my fellow commissioners, was the announcement of the return of the Native American tribal land in California that involved the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone Reservation. It was just really, I think, a hallmark and a highlight and an example of what can happen when the commission is very serious about not only our history and the culture of California, but certainly when these opportunities arise that have the potential of being able to further preserve and protect our tribal cultural resources. We definitely are going to take action and move in that direction. But just also not letting up with respect to the work that needs to be done to continue to build resiliency to our lands relative to sea level rise. We heard some amazing presentations today around that. The idea that this commission and the staff has gone into essentially the oil platform shuttering business is also nothing short of remarkable in the progress that continues to be made there. But I wanted to just conclude by saying that you know, we find ourselves at this time of really at the confluence of so much that is happening, and this commission has really embraced this moment that with the public health pandemic really sparing no region and no community today, to the recession that is really hitting many, many communities in California and across this nation, to the continuing necessary outcry for racial equity and justice, and of course, the impacts of climate change that is also not sparing any region of the state. This commission has stepped up and responded to every one of those issues. And I think the work that we are doing, the example that we are really modeling, I hope for other parts of the state, is one that I'm just personally very proud of. And I hope to continue to be involved in this work, and definitely want to thank our sister agencies, the Ocean Protection Council, the strategic plan that it adopted this year with much input from this commission, as well as the California Coastal Commission, its ongoing work on sea level rise, but also to you, Jennifer, for your leadership of this commission. You know, this is a very stressful time for so many in our communities and so many with whom we share this space at work and in the commitment and mission of the commission. And I just need to give you a shout out for the complete embrace and acceptance of just what happens when we don't really pay attention to issues of equity, and the space that you've allowed your staff team to really take, and the time for them to take to really deepen their understanding about you know, race and equity is something that I think is a model for all of the rest of state government. I know it's been a model for me and what we're doing in the state controller's office as well. And then lastly, I want to just give a personal thanks. Many of you have worked with her, but I wanted to just give an acknowledgement and pay tribute to my former deputy controller for environmental policy, Ann Baker, who has had decades of experience in this work. And I'm sure as she's watching to see so much of you know, her fingerprints and you know, the blueprints that she has laid out reach this point of where we're taking action has got to be just very heartening. But definitely wanted to extend my thanks to her and for her vision, and to hopefully just say to her, I hope that we are fulfilling, you know, just the vision she had when she began this work decades ago. And then as we're concluding open session, just to really wish everyone a healthy, safe, and meaningful holiday season, and hope that everyone can just take very good care. Let me open it up to my fellow commissioners for any comments before we go into closed session. Thank you. It's really an honor to serve with all of you. Yes, Commissioner Kunalakis, please.
I just wanted to again thank you for your leadership this last year, and echo and agree with many of the important points that you just made. It really has been quite a year. Who would have thought this would be the new normal for our commission meeting? And it's not over yet, that we can see the light at the end
of a tunnel that is going to be tough to get through the next few months. Yeah. So thank you, Madam Chair. And here's to 2021.
Here's to 2021. I'm looking forward to your chairship next year. Thank you. Commissioner Miller.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a huge thank you to you and the Lieutenant Governor, and not only the team at State Lands, but also just all the people we hear from all the time. I have really learned a lot, and it's been just a privilege to be a part of a small part of this team. And I think during these incredibly dark times, this has really been a light of the difference we can make and the change we can make. And has been a great example of that. So I'm very, very grateful that I had this privilege. So thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of it.
Absolutely. No, thank you. And a great, huge thank you to the commission staff. I'm looking at Seth, and you know, you think of these times as where we're all feeling challenged, but yet, you know, we all just keep rising to the occasion, and just for the great work of our legal shop and the tremendous contributions of the staff throughout the organization. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Lucchese, I believe the next order of business is closed session. Yes.
It is. Just quickly, it's an honor to serve alongside and for you three commissioners, and of course, alongside our commission team, who's incredibly talented and dedicated and works very hard to make all of us look so good. With that, thank you for those incredibly kind words. It really is a privilege to work for you three, and I look forward to 2021. Our next order of business is closed session. We will be conducting our closed session via conference call. Commissioners, please email me or call my cell phone if you need the call-in information. And for the commissioners and staff participating in closed session, upon adjournment, please mute your microphone, turn off your webcam, and if possible, go into a different room. This will ensure confidentiality of our discussions.
Great, thank you. We'll now adjourn into closed session. Thank you, everyone.
All right, we are recording and broadcasting.
Chair Yi, you are on mute.
Thank you. Welcome. We're back in open session. The commission met in closed session. Ms. Lucchese, anything to report?
Not at this time.
Okay, very well. Thank you. Seeing no other business coming before the commission, this commission meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone, and have a safe and happy holidays. Thank you.
Thank you. Happy holidays. Take care.
Thank you.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. All right.